Hello everyone and welcome to episode 123 of Dominaria's Judgment, a mostly weekly, mostly constructed magic podcast. I'm Dom Harvey, I'm here with Ari Lax, and this week we are giving you what we promised. This will be the Legacy and Vintage Primer ahead of Eternal Weekend in North America, and I guess also Japan coming up just this weekend as well. But there's some other stuff going on here too. We would be remiss if we didn't talk about the elephant in the room, so to speak.
I don't think we're allowed to talk about that on this family-friendly podcast, unless you're referring to something else.
no need to explain any kind of a background or context on that one. But we will, on top of the Legacy and Vintage discussion, we'll touch on the Modern Showcase results at the very end in the results segment, and we'll touch on Pioneer and all of the skies potentially falling over there at the top here. So if any of those segments do or do not interest you, we'll put the timestamps in the show notes so that you can jump around as you see fit. But a little something for everyone here today.
Yeah, so I guess kicking off Pioneer, we had quite the result in the last showcase, or was it qualifier or showcase challenge? The finalists were very prolific players. So JMM and Triosk, which John Moritz Merkel and Yuki Ichikawa, two very accomplished players. I know John is a Pro Tour champion. Is Yuki win one of the set championships that I'm forgetting about, or does he just have a billion top eights?
He did, and then also Jan won one of those set championships too within the same season. So yes, two recent champions squaring off again, and their choice of deck for that is interesting, both for just, oh my god, what is happening, but also given that they are two of the better players by far in the entire field, they went with two different variations of the kind of Discover Cascade-esque decks that have been popping up. Decks which do not seem to give you a ton of agency, to put it in that very loaded language. And so the fact that these two players decided to put down whatever skill edge they might have over the field in favor of what does seem like a pretty substantial deck edge, deck difference, if you like, that says something. And then just in terms of what these decks are trying to do and the misery of this experience and how repetitive it has been in all of the other formats where you get to cascade slash discover into something reliably, this felt like only a matter of time, maybe. And even though we didn't quite see this exact execution coming when we covered the discover mechanic and the cards in our preview episode, I think we were it wasn't tough for us to say that, okay, this mechanic is just inherently dangerous. I don't think that a fixed version is actually appealing to anyone in the end, and so it can only be some kind of absolute horseshit. And sure enough, a steaming pile of said horseshit has been dumped on the Pioneer format ahead of my regional championship this weekend, the Japanese regional championship too. And from my lofty perch as someone who is not actually playing for a Pro Tour invite here and can afford to kind of phone it in or approach a tournament with a more casual vibe, it is kind of exciting. If I was actually trying hard for this one, I imagine I would be quite frustrated about this turn of events.
Yeah, I mean, this does echo back to thinking more about it. Something that happened the first time Cascade was released into the wild, which was the Bloodbraid Elf, Seismic Assault, Swans of Brynar Gold deck. But I don't feel like these decks have the same charm, and it's hard to pin down exactly why. It might just be because their deck lists aren't 18 spells, 42 lands. And instead, there's just like, there's this first one that's trying to Geological Appraiser into basically ways to copy it, or Eldritch Evolution the Appraiser into a Carnosaur and then cast your whole deck and do all sorts of fun stuff. There's also the Quintorious one where you're playing Quintorious Ken, minus threeing it to discover a clone that copies Quintorious, notably Spark Tumble that makes a copy, and then you eventually just stack up enough of the two damage, gain two life triggers that your opponent dies on the spot. But, like, I think there's just a lot less charm in the fact that these decks just don't really have to play by the Cascade rules. Like, there's so many split cards and channel cards and adventures and leyline bindings around that, like, who cares? Like, you just get to play normal spells all the way up the curve and then win the game with these one card combos. And I think that some of this is like, what did you expect? Because actually, if you look at it, like, if you look at the deck list, it is very specifically the three discover cards they printed that are in the vein of traditional Cascade, where you cast the spell and then get the trigger. But I thought, like, initially my reaction was like, oh, well, like, they should have not made these, but the whole mechanic might be fine. And then I started thinking about, like, it's not that hard to manufacture a world where Discover 4 is also an instant win. And then from there, you've also just printed 5 lanes into the pool that effectively read 5-tap sack, win the game. Like, what? I think that Cascade is just, like, a very, very, very poorly designed mechanic, and trying to do it again is just a really bad idea.
It is very funny to me that they clearly try to put some kind of failsafe on, specifically Geological Appraiser, just with an eye to its casting cost, and, you know, if you are casting a 4-mana card that's discovering 3, like, that has just the lower the number, the higher the potential for something messy to happen. So you see the failsafes on the card, right? If you cast it, discover 3, which, yeah, it means you're not going to be cascading into Ephemerates or some kind of, like, weird thing, like Saheeli Rai, minus to copy it and then go again. But turns out, with a card pool sufficiently large, just good old clones, and they're not good clones, but they're clones, that's all you need. That is enough to get the job done. And seeing the way that those decks have like iterated rapidly over time, where you can build the very basic appraiser into a bunch of clones idea, but then you have this question of, well, is just making a bunch of power enough against some of the linear decks or decks that have sweepers and so on? And so you then move to Eldritch Evolution, where appraiser hits that, and then that jumps you up the curve to your Carnosaur, which, when that starts cascading, you have just more power, first of all, but then also, once you then have your chain in place and you get another evolution, that can then get a Doomscar Titan or some big thing that just gives everything haste, or the most charming, grading on a curve here, but the most charming part of some of these lists is the Galta, where if you draw the Doomscar Titan, or you've just drawn a bunch of other, like, Carnosaurs and so on, you just evolution the first Carnosaur into the Galta, put everything into play, and then just keep the chain going and go again. And I don't know if the best version of this deck is, like, capped in how good it can ever really be once it's a known quantity, and I guess we'll find that out in this round of RCs this weekend and for however long this strategy is legal for. But to touch on the comparison that you made, I think the Swan's Seismic Assault stuff landed better, even though it was in Standard, where in theory stuff like this shouldn't be possible, because maybe that is part of it, first of all, is that Standard usually doesn't have some kind of format-defining combo deck, and so at the point where this showed up, it was almost like this exotic, refreshing novelty, as opposed to, oh, here we go again, right? The way that it might be in Modern. Also, Swans plus Seismic Assault is just kind of cool as hell. Like, it's just a very funny thing to exist, especially those cards existing in the same Standard format. And then also, I think the crucial thing is that you can cascade into your Seismic Assault, and that is one part of your combo. The other part still has to take care of itself, though, right? You have to find the Swans, or you had the charming kind of scrappy games where your 40 land deck, you were manually Seismic Assaulting stuff down so that your Blood Raid Elf could get in for 3, and then the Assault itself could go upstairs and be like this form of reach. So you did have these weird scrappy games. It wasn't literally the same thing every single time once your combo gets going, which has been the mold for basically every Cascade combo deck that we've seen since then. Like, that is by far the exception and not the rule.
Yeah, the two-card combo thing, I think, is the piece that you touched on that's probably the biggest deal. I mean, even if you did in that format usually die to just, like, Seismic Assault and every draw step being a land, there was still game to be played there, as opposed to just, like, their entire libraries on the battlefield.
And then on the other side, we have the Quintorious Canned variation, where the idea here is you play the new Quintorious, 5-mana Planeswalker, a bunch of text, but the relevant abilities are when you cast a spell from exile, you drain them for 2, and then the -3 is you discover 4. And so if every time you do that, you are regenerating or copying your Quintorious can, then you just get to do that over and over again and keep triggering that static ability in the process. And so the real hit here is Spark Double, which lets you get a new Quintorious, which is not legendary, so you end up controlling 2 of those at once. And then that makes it pretty trivial at that point to just start stacking up triggers and deal lethal. But you also have, like, Clever Impersonator, Mythos of Aluna, stuff like that, if you want it. So lots of ways to make that instantly lethal. And then this is also a Carnosaur deck, because with that same mana value restriction on your curve, every time you cast Carnosaur, you are cascading into either a Quintorious to keep the chain going there, or a clone, which can just keep cloning the Carnosaur, and it's the the same idea there. So two slightly different ways to basically get to the same conclusion. And there are cards which are broadly good against both, so I would expect a lot more Damping Spheres going into this weekend than I did last time, which has these second order effects, right? Like if you were some like Lotus combo main, well, now you have these faster linear decks, which may be a problem in their own right. And then also some of the ways that people are trying to attack those, you're going to catch a lot of stray splash damage from there as well. And then I guess there's stuff like Rule of Law effects, Lavinia, so on and so forth. But even those, you have to really think through the implications. So Damping Sphere, for example, that is going to interrupt any kind of geological appraiser shenanigans for the most part. But the Quintorius deck, if you keep, let's say, you're playing Jabberwocky's Black Red Sackless that has four Damping Spheres in the sideboard. Maybe you Mulligan looking for your hate card. You keep a pretty medium stakes because it has a Damping Sphere. What's going to happen is they'll play the Quintorius, they'll just tick it up, make a blocker, and then next turn, once they have five or six mana to play with, then they start cascading, and they can just start paying through the Damping Sphere, and it doesn't take many activations for them to just drain a bunch of life and generate a pretty lethal board on its own through some kind of hate card like that. So you have to really think through the logic of what is my hate card doing? Is it actually a functional hate card the way that I need it to be? And then also, these decks can't quite pivot the way that their modern counterparts can, but there is still stuff like the Appraiser deck with the four Magma Opus, four Creative Outburst. You can just sideboard into a bunch of, let's say, Torrential Gearhawks, for example, and now you play this game where you are reliably Gearhawking something big on turn five, even turn four, and the opponent who's been sitting there with their Bone Crusher Giant up every turn just waiting to catch your Appraiser is going to be left out of the loop by that. So I think, and that's before you get into even more radical stuff, like what if your Appraiser deck just has four Fables in the sideboard, right? And so against opponents who are trying to one-for-one you or hate you out, you just play Fable, and then sometimes you play your 3/2, get a Fable. Like, that's a pretty good exchange for four mana in the face of, like, a Stomp or something. And then once you get towards the top, then you're starting to copy your Carnosaurs or Gearhawks or whatever. Like, even without thinking about radical stuff like that, I would not assume that, oh, I'll just put some removal in my deck and call it a day. Like, that's not going to be good enough.
Yeah, I think it's more of going to be a structural shift towards decks that are inherently disruptive, like Spirits, or I noticed Azorius Lotus Field has done very well in recent preliminaries. That's what this is going to force.
If you had a deck locked in going into your Pioneer tournament a week ago, can you just tweak a few cyborg cards and call it a day? Or is this a fundamental, like, the whole terms of engagement here in the format are changing, and if my deck does not thrive in those, as, you know, mono green, for example, I think is a big loser out of all of this, do you just have to bail into something else, or are we in that territory here?
I think that we are for certain decks. Like you said, Lotus Field, I think, is the real loser because a good percentage of the hate cards also hit it in some way. Like, whether it's, again, structurally in terms of archetypes or actual cards that are problems. I think that there's a section of the metagame that can just adapt, but you really have to make that assessment.
Yeah, there are. I think the other thing that you touched on earlier with the split cards and channel cards and just other ways to get around that that discover restriction, this is the same thing that has made that experience so repetitive in Modern, where if that was a really meaningful cast, that would be one thing. But in a world of evoke elementals and forces and split cards going back even further and all of this other stuff, it feels like you just play the deck that you want to play with, like, very minor sacrifices and unlock this incredibly powerful and repetitive like mid-game or end-game tactic in return. And that's just, I don't feel like you had to work from it. Like, if you, when my Living End opponent Living Ends me and just puts 15 power and a grief into play, it's like, how much did you really have to warp the way that you would have wanted to build your deck otherwise to make that possible? And I don't think the answer is as high as it needs to be. And even in Pioneer, you don't have grief and force negation and so on, but you do have this weird and wacky array of split cards, which it is funny to see, like, Repudiate Replicate finally getting its day in the sun, right? Where the showcase finals was decided by Yuki Ichikawa repudiating to counter the trigger on JMM's Carnosaur and then untapping and just casting his clone on his opponent's Carnosaur to, like, piggyback off that to go off himself. That is funny the first time you hear that joke, but it stops being funny pretty quickly, I think.
Yeah, the mirror matches where, like, neither player can technically do anything out of that kind of fear are not... I mean, it's the Living End mirror match you're describing, right? You can't Living End because they'll Living End and then everything's bad. It's the same thing. Yeah, it's kind of interesting how, over the years, we, like, everyone jokes about, like, arbitrary game object tokens being a design thing that they've turned to a lot. But it feels like this sort of trend towards cards that cost not really the amount that they actually cost has increased a lot in the last few years. It's hard to tell if it's, like, significantly more, because split cards came around, like, a few times over the years, but, like, between those, adventure, everything else, like, I don't know. I don't know where the line is drawn in terms of, like, how much of this is, like, the overlap of, like, design trends and a bad mechanic versus just, like, the mechanic's fault.
Yeah, well, one comparison that's jumping to mind as well is, did you see the Inquisitor cabinet deck that was all over Historic for a hot minute?
What?
Okay, so Inquisitor Captain, for the people who have wisely not logged into Arena in quite some time, yeah, this was the 4-mana 3-3 when it ETBs, if you cast it, there's that line again, and there are 20 or more creature cards that cost 3 or less between various zones, you basically get a choice of two of those to put into play. And so there was a deck that existed that was just Captain and a bunch of the cheap clones doing exactly the same thing, bypassing exactly the same restriction, and maybe with exactly the same result. Like, I guess in that case, Inquisitor Cabin was just nerfed out of playability, which you can't really do here and don't want to do here, but there is a ban update, not an emergency one, a scheduled one, but maybe it will have a sense of urgency about it by the time that rolls around in 2 weeks.
Yeah, I think we will... That's a kind of we'll see thing. I tweeted this too, but ignoring all of, like, how good is this combo, I don't really understand why the fair applications of Bloodbraid Elf were something that people wanted. I don't get it. Like, who sat down and played through Bloodbraid Elf Standard and were like, yeah, let's do that. I think that there is a big gap between the printing of Discover cards that are costed for EDH and the, like, specifically Appraiser that is costed for Constructed, just because, like, the way the mechanic works in 60-card 4-0 formats is completely different than the way it works in any singleton format, in that, like, the hyper-repetitive gameplay is just a feature of what you're supposed to do. Like, even if you talk about the context of Jund, which is kind of like the argument I got into, is, like, the Jund Cascades, like, even though your deck was a bunch of cards, they were hyper-consistent, and you sideboarded to make them even more consistent. The consistency was just, like, I produce 2.5 game units of value by casting Bloodbraid Elf, but 15% of the time my opponent also instantly loses the game because I hit the precisely correct one. It's just none of it's fun. None of it is either just, like, a Demonic Tutor and a Black Lotus, or just, like, the most arbitrary card unit thing you could imagine. I just don't really understand.
This was the whole story of the Alara Block PT as well, right? Where you had all of these 4-color, 5-color Cascade decks, which even in that card pool, which is as small as any format's card pool really gets, you could optimize your deck in sideboarding so that against the mirror or the slower decks, you were always cascading into Blightnings and Esper Charms and so on. And then against the aggro decks of the world, well, hey, it turns out every time I cascade, I get, like, a Terminate or a War of Denial. What are the odds, right? Who could have guessed?
Yeah, I do see one final point you have made of Crystal Grotto exclamation mark.
Yeah, do you know the lore here?
No, I don't know the lore of why Crystal Grotto is showing up.
Okay, so if you look at JMM's decklist, you will see not Crystal Grotto, in fact, but Zalfarin Void. So this was a card which popped up in some combo decks, you know, across the years back in the day, and they decided to make a strictly better version of that card in World's Eldrain, but JMM's been out of things for a while now, hasn't really kept up with the latest sets, especially for Limited, and so when he's cobbling together his first sketch of this apparently broken concept, he decides, okay, well, I want this effect, I'll just play some Zalfarin Void. Not realizing that Crystal Grotto, in fact, exists, and the fixing is shockingly relevant in a deck with a bunch of like double hybrid casts for its split cards and its you know, channel casts and so on. Like that is a meaningful difference. But if you go and look at the league list and the prelim list for like the day or two after, you'll see a lot of Crystal Grottos showing up there from people who, or Zalfarin Voids, excuse me, from people who literally put zero thought into the cards in the deck and just copied the exact 75, which generally a fine thing to do for a JMM deck list or a Yuki Ichikawa deck list, but sometimes it leads to these funny outcomes. And it's almost like the like when studios will like put different typos deliberately in scripts that they hand out so that if they get leaked, they can identify exactly who it was. You know, if you see a Zalfarin Void, exactly what happened here and who to blame for it. So I don't know if... I think that effect is fine. On my soapbox here for a moment, I think the temples in these decks are just complete nonsense. Because... yeah, in theory, you take your first turn off or whatever, and you get some like free-ish boost in consistency that way. But that is so far outweighed by the times where you need to draw the fourth mana for Appraisal, or especially the like sixth mana for Carnosaur, and you draw a temple. Like that is a game-losing tap land a lot of the time. So I would move away from that. But that's a minor change in the grand scheme of things. I do want to, while I'm on the soapbox, touch on what you said about just. Specifically split cards, but also there is a wider trend here where Cascade has a long rap sheet to answer for in its own right, but the bigger issue of cards just don't have singular well-defined properties anymore, which that gate was thrown open by split cards over 20 years ago, but it's only got worse over time, to where like how should a card like Boom Bust interact with Cascade? Right, there was a long time where you cast a Blood Raid Elf, you hit you went past Boom Bust, that would stop the count because Boom cost two, but then once that was checked, you could deal whatever you want and you could cast the bust half as Armageddon. And there were a bunch of decks popping up to exploit that synergy, which was cool, but it was cool because you knew this was something which you should not be allowed to do. And there was like this weird loophole that allowed for that. And then there was a set of Cascade rule changes with Amonkhet, like anticipating weirdness there with the Aftermath cards, where I have fun like casting Torrential Gearhulk to cast the memory half of Commit Memory, even though that half's a sorcery, but again, like, who's letting me do that? And so that those changes meant that when you are doing that kind of check now, you just find the total mana value of the halves on the card and add them up. And so these days, you cast Bloodbraid Elf, you go past Boom Bust, even though Boom cost two, like, you have found a two-cost card, the total mana cost 2+6 is 8, so you ignore that. It seems to me the most intuitive way of handling that would be, oh, you have found a card that costs two, you can use the option to cast that card that costs two and not the one that costs six, and yet somehow that is the one possible interpretation that has never been codified in how Cascade interacts with these things. And that's before you get into the silliness of like Cascade into Valky, where they just essentially hotfix the way Cascade works in the rules to stop that from happening anymore, where you stop the check at Valky, but then you cast the 7 mana backside, which I'm glad that they stopped that. I'm still not sure why I can bring to light for a 2 mana Valky and cast a 7 mana half, and don't get me started on Deadly Vanity and that all of that horseshit. But like there's that whole class of stuff too, and then even things like your Charbelcher deck gets to play 20 plus actual lands because of the like Zendikar Rising DFCs. There's this whole category of like weird accounting loopholes where, yeah, you can build cool decks with them, but you don't feel a sense of achievement in doing that because like you haven't, you know, discovered some obscure Odyssey card that works really well with this new Wilds of Eldraine card and you're going to take your Legacy tournament by storm. You feel like you essentially just like lied on your tax return or something. Like what are we actually doing here?
Yeah, that is a good point about, I've never really like put the two and two together about how MDFCs and split cards like just have completely inverted ways they interact with Cascade, and like it doesn't make a lot of sense. Yeah, it would maybe be nice if the split cards worked the way Valky did, where they had mana value two and you flip them and you can only cast the mana value two half. Yeah, that might be nice. I, on the note of Aftermath cards, you mentioned that, and that brought up in some of the lists, a card that I'm glad to see because I just kind of forgot it existed and it makes me smile in these lists is Reduced to Rubble. Big fan of that one showing up in the sideboards. Originally, this was going to be a rant about Mirror Shell Crab being the one awesome part of this deck, but like, reduced to rubble and Mirror Shell Crab can, you know, share that spotlight. Really love it.
Yeah, but pull one out for a Brain in a Jar with Fuse cards as well while we're here. Again, another thing which was very cool because it shouldn't have been allowed to exist, and they sure didn't allow it to exist for very long. In any case, before we move on from Pioneer, I guess, call your shot. Will this still be a thing you can or should do in Pioneer by the time we get to the Pro Tour in February?
Probably not in February, no. I think that it will either be resolved in one way or another.
Yeah, I don't know what that will look like, because when you have two different decks like this, do you hit both of the namesake Discover cards? Do you hit the Carnosaur, which is like the common element in both, but then you still get to do the like turn three appraiser thing a lot of the time? You just find a different way there. Do you change the Cascade rules again so that, kind of in line with what we're talking about here, to where these decks now would not have access to any of the commonly played split cards, which I think that might be enough to actually solve the issue to a degree, because if you're effectively doing nothing until you can do your one thing, and that one thing can be disrupted, that's not a recipe for consistent success. But either way, a weird discussion that we have to be having here. It does remind me, I guess, of the Oops decks in Pioneer, which were allowed to run rampant for a few months at this time, like in 2020, when no one was paying attention to Pioneer, and those decks were never that good or successful, and they were easy enough to hate out if you decided that's what you wanted to do, but just the sheer repetition of those play patterns and the fact that there was just this sense of, yeah, this isn't right, like, why are we allowed to do this? That was enough to get both Undercity Informer and Ballastrade Spy on the banners there. So I think that is the fate in store for this, probably. How long it takes and how many regional championships get sacrificed to those in between is less clear at this stage.
Yeah, I think I'm probably like, I'm not like a 100% on whether bans happen or the format just kind of makes some drastic shift. If Winota is banned, I guess you kind of, like, that's, I don't think you can reckon Winota being banned and these not. Like, it's on the same level of warping. And I think that you pointing to the Oops decks and the fact that Informer and Balustrade Spy are just both on the ban list kind of implies, if anything gets banned, I expect it's just both cards. And then, like, I don't know, you just have a bunch of time bombs with the rest of the Cascade spells sitting around, but whatever.
Yeah. I mean, I think my verdict on Discover will be the exact same verdict that we had on Cascade 15 years ago, which is pretty cool in, like, limited or singleton constructed formats where, by definition, you can't, like, stack the deck in this exact way. If you give people any room to breathe in, you know, regular constructed, they will figure out a way to make you regret ever doing this, and we already learned that. So why we're doing this again is not clear to me. But anyhow, I guess also call your shot. If you are playing some relevant Pioneer tournament this weekend, are you discovering? Are you flipping over cards until you reveal something with a lesser or equal mana value?
I think I would need to go back and play with the updated list of Boros Convoke before making that decision. I think that I could be talked into Boros, or is it Phoenix instead? But that's it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm currently, as of Wednesday afternoon here, waffling between some build of blue white, some discover deck of some description for my RC, and it feels like that's a choice that a lot of people are making from what I've heard through the grapevine. So this weekend is going to be very strange and very messy, and hopefully one that we can look back on as like this weird anomaly and not just the updated state of Pioneer for the next however many months. Let's move swift.
Well, I do want to bring up one thing, is even if you ban these cards, there's a card called Itali's Favor, which I'm sure, like, I forgot this existed until it randomly popped up at the top of the limited commons in the set for red, but it's just two and a red for an aura with ETB Discover 3 and gives +1/+1 and trample. And I feel like even if you ban these cards, I'm just like looking at this card, I'm like, I don't really know exactly how the game ends, but it feels like 3 mana Discover 3 just ends the game in some way.
Yeah, I'm already thinking for Modern, is there stuff you can do with like Colony Garden or Fetchable Dryad Arbor, or like if you just want another 3 mana cascade-ish effect, then that does exist now, and there's some potential there as well. Maybe let's move on to the Eternal Weekend of it all then. So we have Legacy and Vintage to be looking ahead to. Which of these do we even want to start with?
Let's start. I think this is a question of, do you want to start with vibes or math? And I think the answer is just vibes. We got to talk about vintage because vintage is all vibes. Legacy is all math. Vintage is really fun right now. You've listed this as parentheses derogatory question mark, question mark, but it was actually like meant seriously and earnestly, even though it sounds really stupid. My read of vintage after having started testing it is that it's just constructed vintage cube these days.
Go on.
So I think that the thing that has kind of turned around to dominate, like if you draft vintage cube right now, the things that kind of come to mind are like, there are very powerful threats and endgames. Very powerful threats and endgames. Cheap cards are very powerful but scarce, and answers are powerful and scarce too. And that, I think, kind of defines the current state of vintage. I guess to kind of maybe preface this, I don't even know if this is the right order to talk about this, but I'll just talk about the sort of something I've kind of noticed is that if I were to rank my top few cards in vintage right now, most important, most powerful, 1 and 2 are Time Walk Ancestral, 3 is Force of Will, and 4 is Black Lotus. And that kind of is a statement about how I feel about the format, which is that I think that... In a lot of formats, we are largely past the true combo era where, like, a Tendrils Chain is ending the game, and more into an era where you are trying to cast single cards that end the game. Okay, great. That's cool. But one of the things I think about Vintage that's interesting is that there are a lot of ways for you to end up not winning the game, but end up so far ahead on cardboard of your opponent that it doesn't matter that you haven't won the game on the spot. You will just win the game because your cardboard begets more cardboard in the future and also begets free answers in the form of Force Will, and your opponent will never get off the ground and will lose the game on the spot. So you are like, a lot of the games are decided by pseudo combos where because one player gets ahead and like hits one of these big things that puts them ahead enough of a chunk, they spiral ahead into being further ahead while their opponent is just trapped on the ground and never getting anywhere. So when you start thinking about that, you actually end up in a spot where, like, there's a lot of relatively low investment ways to do that in the format. I think maybe, like, looking at the Oath decks is the best example because they kind of play to this exact principle of, like, you are just putting an Oath on the battlefield. You are casting a Show and Tell. You don't have to go through these huge hoops of producing some 6-mana permanent or, like, ritual, like, Tutor, Yogg-Will, this giant chain where you're investing a bunch of cards. You can often, I mean, there's a problem where there's a shortage of interaction to do this, but you can often just, like, have 2 threats, play through their force, have 2 counters back to stop their thing. Like, I think that Vintage is one on those levels of fight where, like, you want to create these, you want to produce a bunch of threats that put you at least the bare minimum ahead to win the game without investing as many resources as possible. And that kind of relates to, like, the vintage cube aspect of it, of, like, the big threats, the Primeval Titans and stuff of the world have gotten worse and worse over the years. It's less about, like, Crater Hoofs, and it's more about just, like, I don't know, beat this dragon, good luck, or, like, the Reanimate Archon, like, the more compact, mana-efficient plays, and then trying to really have also access to, like, the Thought Seizes of that world, which are the Force of Wills of this world to deal with that. I think that one other weird thing I've noticed about this is that also sort of makes this format as condensed as possible on turns, because a lot of this action, it doesn't always start on turn one, but it can. So any cards that are trying to provide a delayed overtime advantage are pretty bad. Like, one of the biggest card for this is Mishra's Bauble. I think that card is stone cold unplayable and should just not be in your vintage decks. It's really, really bad. It just doesn't do anything. The games that I would much rather play a Nihil Spellbomb or an Aether, just any vintage legal cantrip artifact that I can loop with Lurrus that might actually interact with my opponent is better than stupid Mishra's Bauble. That's where I'm at.
Yeah, so going back to the kind of mission statement there, I would almost say that Time Walk is the worst that it's been in quite a long time, to where if you, but the reasons why are maybe illuminating about the format as a whole. So if you look at a lot of the blue decks that can support Time Warp is it's either the combo decks like Besiege and Jewel, where you play it because it's a broken card and it's a blue card, like that's not an irrelevant part of it either. And sometimes you'll find yourself using it to good effect, but usually at the point where you're so far ahead that it's just kind of a formality, and the Time Warp is almost this ritual effect that untaps your mana so you can cast a thing that actually wins the game. Or it's these kind of hard control decks like the Lurrus decks, where it's not even stuff like Jeskai of old, where maybe Time Walk is letting you clock again with your Ragavan or your Arcanist or something, or if you have a bunch of Planeswalkers ticking up or anything like that. It's essentially just, same thing again, this maybe gets me to Chapter 2 of my Urza Saga a turn sooner, and I get like one anemic hit in with my Bowmaster, but what else is the card really doing for me? And that, to me, highlights that the kind of various extreme poles of the format have all been strengthened and are all things you have to somehow care about at the same time, which has left the decks in between really kind of floundering around, because the only reliable generic interaction is good old Force of Will, and everything else has some pretty big holes which you can't like stitch together to not leave any gaps, because it's just impossible given the spread of threats in the format at the moment. Yeah, the tools you need against Oath versus the Besiege and Jewel decks over here versus the hard control decks over here, but then you also have like Fair Tinker and, oh look, there's Initiative and Prison Shops and your Bazaar is still a thing that exists, and just nothing reactive actually covers your base against all of those, which then pushes you in this direction of I want to be doing something powerful and proactive, and then using whatever interaction I do have as a way to force that through, instead of trying to fight this like long defensive battle where inevitably some kind of mismatch is going to occur and I just might not have the tools to deal with that.
Yeah, it's very hard to plan those battles in this format, because again, the threats outstrip the answers on raw quantity, so there's no realistic way to predict at what point like you're gonna run out and your opponent might not have, like, they'll just force something through eventually. Like, you have to be forcing back against them. It may be partially skewed by my experiences playing Oath, where Time Walk is like phenomenally way better than in any other shell, just because of the nature of Oath of Druids. I think there's actually kind of like a weird thing in Vintage where, and this is like a tension in the Oath deck specifically, where some people have Gaia's Blessing and some don't, because it's not like raw quantity deck exhaustion that occurs. Trying to think of like that has happened in recent formats a couple times. It's like there are a few key restricted effects that if you have used them in a game, because of the amount of tutors and card draw, if you no longer have access to them, it drastically changes the power level of your cards. Where if there's some way for you to have access to a second Time Walk or something in a game, that really changes the texture of what's going on. And I think Time Walk is like the effect that has like some of the biggest deltas in those spots, where just like having access to it in your deck drastically changes the game.
Yeah, I do think the Vintage Cube comparison of a lot of the decks can do some very busted things, but those things don't necessarily fit together all that well, and so you just kind of try to look for a window where your whatever your powerful thing is left over lines up against whatever their reactive card is left over. This is one thing which, as I've watched people cube more recently after a few years of really not doing much myself, I feel like all of the old heuristics that I used to have for Vintage Cube just don't apply anymore. And I almost think that my decks from 5 years ago look a lot more coherent, and they're better at being a deck that does this thing, but they're just worse overall because they don't have these absurd power outliers, which, yeah, like your deck doesn't need to be built around fourth Aeolingus, right? You are just a deck that has a fourth Aeolingus in it, and sometimes you'll draw that card and you'll win the game because it's broken. And then sometimes, you know, you're doing whatever the hell it is that you thought you were doing when you were midway through pack one, right? And I think that as you get this increased density of just big, heavy hitters that can win the game by themselves, like the deck building and the responses to that just naturally tend in that direction. And that's as true in Vintage Cube as it is just in plain old Vintage. So with that in mind, my usual default of just play some kind of blue Saga Tinker deck has felt a lot less reliable, because I'm not as good at doing a broken thing as like Oath or the combo decks or whatever, but also am I as good at containing that as the hard control deck? So I'd like, no, I'm not really that either. So I'm not sure what my deck is meant to be specifically good at anymore, other than just being like slightly good enough at everything that hopefully I can figure it out.
Yeah, I do like one deck in that sort of general frame, and that's the Lurrus PO deck. I need to put some more reps in with it and probably cut the Glimmer Voids for real lands, but I have liked that deck. It has looked very powerful because it does that sort of mishmash kind of thing, but does it in a way that feels like it's respecting the new rules of the format.
Yeah, in the same vein, I had some interest in just Lurrus Breach, because your Breach is a mess up card. It's a great thing to pair with Lurrus, and they even encourage you to play some of the same like ancillary cards that work well with them. But you also do now have this thing which just drives a wedge through an unsuspecting opponent, and you don't have to actually win a game by attacking like 8 times with a Bowmaster or something. Like you have a much more defined, powerful plan to work towards.
Okay, let's talk about Bowmaster. I think that card is garbage in this format. And I have basically found myself in spots where I don't really... Like, my opponent Bowmasters and then, like, whatever. Like, I'm just going to draw 3 with Ancestral and then kill them with the cards I drew or whatever. It's not like it's Bowmastering into a Time Twister in most spots. I think Hull Breacher might just be a better card in the format, because when you Hull Breacher, they don't get the cards. They don't actually get to win the game.
Oh, yeah. I mean, Hull Breacher is a fantastic card. It's been a mainstay of all of the blue Saga Tinker lists that I played for months now. Much less so recently than if you go back to, you know, 3 or 4 months ago, because, you know, Bowmaster has dampened down a lot of the stuff which Hull Breacher is trying to prey upon. And just in general, stuff like, you know, when Jewel was the most popular combo deck, and, you know, Squeevine, Hollowvine were the popular Bazaar decks, and all the blue decks also had a bunch of draw effects. Well, now it felt like Hull Breacher is just kind of good against everything, except, like, Initiative or someone playing Dredge or something. But now you have, like, Oath, which almost actively wants to see a Hull Breacher. You have other combo decks, which maybe you'll occasionally tag that Ancestral or something, but for the most part, they just don't care. There's a lot of stuff where that card is a lot more polarizing than it was in the past, but that applies even more so to Bowmaster, where I've seen a lot of the Lurrus control pilots question whether they even want Bowmaster in their deck against Coveted Jewel, where if the entire conceit of the deck is casting a big paradoxical outcome to pick up my Coveted Jewel and my One Ring and all of these other things, which you would think these kind of draw punishers would line up well against, like, those cards are just kind of laughable in practice, because if your opponent is drawing 10 cards with their fast mana combo deck, they're just going to kill you. You won't get to attack with your orc, and unless you are actually dealing lethal, nothing in between up to that point is going to matter at all. I feel like that's kind of true of just Bowmaster as a whole, and like Bazaar has not been as popular, and even within that category, you see like Dredge doing well compared to other Bazaar decks, and Bowmaster is actually like pretty underwhelming against Dredge. And so all of these factors push me away from liking Bowmaster as a card. And specifically, if you don't like Bowmaster as a card, then what are we doing with the black cards in our blue-black Lurrus control deck? And this is a conclusion which you've seen a few different people arrive at independently. So Discover End, you know, noted Doomsday Crusher vintage expert, won a challenge this past weekend with just blue-white Lurrus, where instead of Bowmaster, we have Lavinia. Instead of these, like, mopey conditional removal spells, we just have actual Swords of Plowshares, still the best of all time after 30 years. And to me, like, that color shift has moved it from a deck which I wouldn't want to touch in a million years to a deck that is now, like, I'm actively considering as a frontrunner for the tournament. Notably, the whitelist also has Containment Priest in the sideboard as one of the best hoses you can have against Oath, including all of Oath, Show and Tell, Flash, just the whole gamut. It gets all of them. And also a pretty good sideboard card against most of the Bazaar decks, even though it's like pretty slow unless you're ramping it out with a Mox or something. But to me, that list reflects a much better understanding of where the format is going. And actually, Mogged, who pioneered the blue-black Lurrus Bowmaster deck, also top-aided that challenge with a blue-white version. So I think that shift is in full effect, and maybe by the time we get to Pittsburgh in a few weeks, that is going to be the default way to build that deck. And if that's the case, a lot of other stuff will have to be downstream of that, because the Oath deck really rose up as a response to the blue-black deck, and I think its matchup against the blue-white version is a lot worse. And it's still a fine deck for the most part, but like its main like raison d'etre just has disappeared at that stage.
How much do you like the Bazaar decks right now? Because my experience was that they kind of felt really bad against everything I was playing, so I haven't played the Bazaar decks, just because they've been losing to everything.
Yeah.
I think that it's a really bad spot of, like, the powerful plays overwhelming their plays, Wasteland being prevalent, people just, like, this is before you even start talking about sideboarding, opposing decks being less linear, so your one Mind Break Trap or Force of Vigor a game is not as crushing. I'm just not in for Bazaar. And I guess to tag onto that, what do you think about the Workshop decks with two very traditional Shops decks coming out of nowhere in top 16 in the EU champs?
I'm not a Bazaar main. I've never really felt an affinity to those decks, and I don't think the circumstances of the format now would make me change that view. It's always been the case, and it's still true, that your Bazaar opponent keeps seven, you feel like a sense of dread coming on. It's going to be tough to fight through, but I don't think that if you're on the fence that you need to be like picking up the Bazaars and you know, running those decks through their paces necessarily. I do think if you are, and this is where the card access question comes into play, if you are someone who owns Bazaars or can get Bazaars, but maybe cannot get, you know, fully powered blue deck of some kind, then I think a Bazaar deck is a perfectly fine choice. But it's not something which, given like perfect liquidity or whatever, I would actively be looking to play. And then for Shops, yeah, you've seen both aggro Shops and Prism Shops, and I did play against actual factual Smokestack in my winning in that challenge last weekend. But the more conventional Prism Shops decks, I think it's not a great time to be a Shops deck, but there's just fundamentally something powerful enough going on there that once they are forgotten about and people just like stop taking them seriously, then you can kind of target a place in the Shop spectrum to just punish that really efficiently. If people are like, they don't have any main deck ways to really remove artifacts either one by one or en masse, and then you have these combo decks which a lot of them really struggle to beat, like a Nolrod or just Trinisphere, Chalice, whatever, then yeah, I mean, these decks are going to be somewhat fine choices. And then you get into the kind of sub-discussion of, is this a main deck Nolrod Shops kind of world? How do you handle the faster starts from the combo decks before you can get your lock pieces down? So like, are you meant to be sideboarding a bunch of Mind Bait traps and stuff like that? I do think that the drop off in Doomsday has been great news for Shops too. Like, if you're in a world where you have like two Archive traps in your sideboard just to try and cheese them out, I wouldn't even bother at that stage. I think I would just like, okay, I'll take my L there and try and use those slots more effectively against the format at large. I don't think we are in that spot. Like, even Discover N himself moving away from Doomsday at this stage, and that is maybe good news for Shops. Bad news for Shops is Oath is maybe an even scarier matchup, and that deck is absolutely everywhere. It was, I think, 15% in Prague. I think about double the next most popular archetype. Would not expect that same imbalance for the other Eternal Weekends, but still, that's like a kind of terrifying prospect to have to work through.
Yeah, I agree there, and I don't think I'm going to get the sample size with, I don't know, I'm not a workshop scientist, and maybe the answer is just leave that to them. Let's see, what about the other workshop deck, the Covetous Jewel deck? I hate that deck. I don't understand. Like, when I was talking about, like, expending multiple resources to produce your game-winning effect, I feel like I was calling out exactly that deck in way, like, not the Beseech decks, where, like, it's like, oh, I cast Beseech, it's like, it's just a 4-mana card. You sack an arbitrary piece of cardboard, you win the game. Whatever. That's, like, relatively in line with the format. Jewel Shops is not. Like, I don't understand. I do not understand how this deck wins games. It, like, doesn't have enough blue cards. It, like, tries to be a one-turn kill deck that doesn't go off on turn one because, like, it needs a... It casts a 6-mana spell. Like, I don't get it.
Yeah, the Jewel deck is, I'm convinced it is some kind of elaborate psyop against me specifically. Like, this is some amazing, like, Nathan Fielder Magma Opus. The difference between my experience when I play with a deck and my experience anytime I play against it, it might be the biggest gulf there that I've had from those sides of any Magic deck I've ever tried. Like, when Jewel is doing its thing, it feels absolutely unstoppable. And then when I try and, like, make it do its thing and just try and like even turn the engine on, and it fails to start. It's like, how do I just live in a different reality from other people? Like, what's going on here? It is powerful but volatile, I think, is the broad summary of it. And I think it is good at both just presenting must under threats over and over again. Like, if you are some kind of control deck, it's okay, they lead off with the One Ring. Well, we've got to counter that. Maybe I have to spend two cards for a force of some kind to do that. All right, well, next then they're casting a Coveted Jewel. Got to counter that as well. Or they just have a bunch of like mopey little stuff, and then they play a PO, which that's the bait spell, it turns out. And then the next, the follow-up thing is what gets me. They're like a pretty good Saga deck where you feel like you need to have the early interaction against them, but then your six-card hand that has a Mind Ray Trap in it, they just play a Saga on turn one, and that's the scariest opening they can have. So there's a lot of terrifying stuff going on. I'm not convinced about the overall package, and especially once people start caring about it. Like, when the card Coveted Jewel is bad, it is really, really bad. And I often have wondered if it makes sense to go back to stuff like the Blue Ring decks, which I dabbled with after Lord of the Rings came out, and just be a more like focused deck in that lane, as opposed to trying to warp my deck around Jewel, which feels like the most fragile element of it in the first place. You do also have this weird duality of you get to be like the Trinisphere combo deck, where that is the game winning threat against most people, and ditto with like you are a defense grid forcible deck, because all you care about is resolving your big thing. And so if your defense grid resolves, then great. And if not, well, maybe your next threat backed up with a forcible is going to get across the line. So you can also, the ability to pivot, where in a lot of matchups, the card Coveted Jewel will not even be in your deck, and maybe that should be all of them. But instead you get to just play a bunch of like Wormcoil Engines or Argentum Massacres or God knows what else, and zig while they're zagging in a way that punishes the stuff which hard targets the combo plan. So in the abstract, the deck does have a lot going for it, I think, and it's had a massive resurgence on Magic Online recently, not to quite the same heights that it was a few months ago, but then that more highlights how volatile Magic Online is as well, because when the deck goes from like 20% of every tournament to 2% and then now back to 20%, I don't think the fundamentals have changed enough in the meantime for either change in either direction to really make sense. Like, this should always have been like an 8-10% deck, and instead you're just seeing information cascades in action, I think.
That's fair. I do want to, you mentioned Trinisphere, and I think that there are some lists of this deck that play specifically Mystic Forge and Karn were the cards that I found this with, but one of the things I learned play pattern wise about this format is that you should not be afraid to sideboard out your restricted cards. Like, they're restricted because they're good, but they're not always good in a lot of ways. Like, I was regularly boarding out 3-Sphere Karn and Mystic Forge in a lot of matchups because that's just not what was going on. So when you are going to game two, like, I mean, don't sideboard out Ancestral Time Walk, you know, Lotus, whatever. Just like, there's obviously cards like that, but like, don't be afraid to sideboard out Mystical Tutor, Demonic Tutor. Just like, the cards are just sometimes bad. I don't know what else to say besides like, remember that the whole of your deck exists. I did mention quickly on Misstep, there just aren't one drops in these decks to counter. All the relevant cards cost 2 except for Recall. And half the time, their Spell Pierces are Flusterstorms.
Right, right. I mean, you do sometimes get into weird spots where you misstep a Flusterstorm copy and that like changes the math in a fundamental way, but I agree. I mean, misstep is not at its best right now. You still play it, but be fully prepared to be sideboarding out a decent amount of the time. What decks have appealed to you more? And then once we've covered that, we can maybe get into individual cards which you have mixed opinions about or contrarian views about even.
I think that I have largely liked Oath. The not blue-black Luris sort of PO sector is the next thing I'm going to put time into. I like the idea of Doomsday, but if Discover N has stopped playing it, then I probably should not. And I also want to put some time into the Questing Druid Jeskai deck, just because I got attacked by a Dreadhorde Arcanist and I was just phenomenally impressed, so that's kind of where it is. I don't know. That's the sector of the metagame I've been liking.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've been, with my usual like safety blanket of just generic blue Tinker deck not serving me as well, I've jumped around a bit. I've been liking the Beseech Storm deck quite a bit, actually. Even though it does have just fundamental structural issues, like trying to be a fast mana Urza Saga deck over here and a Dark Ritual like Beseech Mirror deck over here and also a Force of Will deck and everything else. You do get some quite disjointed draws, and you often will end up wondering, like, why did I sign up for this experience? But going back to that point of the format has moved to a place where you really can't expect that kind of coherence or consistency, because that's a trade-off in doing something powerful. That deck is very good at doing something powerful, and better than I expected at both forcing that powerful thing through or just presenting several of them in a row to the point where one of them is going to stick. So I would say at that point, that deck probably is my default for Eternal Weekend. I will keep looking for other things, and there are some scary developments potentially, like if the blue-white Lurrus deck really pops up where 8 forces main deck plus Lavinia, like that's a pretty terrifying recipe for any like Storm combo deck. But if it's mostly still like blue-black Lurrus and Oath and just other random stuff on the side, I really like Beseech's positioning there.
That's fair. I was going to say I really like Lavinia's positioning in the metagame as a whole. It's just a really messed up hate bear.
Yeah, Lavinia is great. Finding a good home for Lavinia is easier said than done. So at one time, that was a big draw to the Blue-White Initiative deck that I was playing a few months ago and gave pretty good reviews to the last time we came in here talking about Vintage. That deck, or that shell, really has fallen off, and I think the card White Plume Adventurer has got a lot worse because of that same factor, where like when the metagame is this broad at all of the extremes, that idea of, well, we'll just trade off cards and then I'll have the last thing standing and the, you know, this is a good last thing to have standing, that's just not so true anymore against most of the decks that are toughest for you. So that part of it is out for me, but just being some kind of Lavinia deck, regardless of what that looks like, that is very appealing, and just fitting that in is the hard part.
Yeah, and I think that maybe the overlap between the non-Oath decks that I am actively interested in, aside from the Doomsday nonsense, which is the Questing Druid deck can be a Lavinia deck, and the like the various blue-white PO nonsense decks can all be Lavinia decks.
Mm-hmm.
Anything else you want to talk about on Vintage? It's really hard to talk about specifics and individual cards. I guess there's a couple on this list of things that I wanted to talk and rant about that, like, we can cover briefly, but, like...
Okay. Quick hit.
There's so much room to change a single card that it's kind of like, what about this 11,000th card in the format? It's like, sure, why not?
Sure. Any that stood out to you in particular?
The two cards that I don't know how to pin down right now, and I don't know how good they are Time Vault and Urza Saga, which is, like, really weird because... So, I've been talking about, like, this idea of slamming threats, and I've had the experience where Urza Saga is simultaneously just, like, a land that doesn't really do anything because it's not operating in the frame of like, oh crap, my opponent is going to cast Oath of Druids and then Show and Tell and I need to beat both of these cards and this Urza Saga does nothing. And then like the other half of the time it's like, well, I just made 2 constructs and my opponent died. I don't really know where to fall with it. It might just be low cost enough that it's just kind of like, I don't know, it's in my deck. It's my like plan like D, E, or F, but like it's good enough.
Yeah, so I would say you're currently seeing a format that is maximally hostile to Urza Saga in the sense of, you know, the shift that you saw towards 4 Wasteland, 4 Saga, 1 Strip Mine decks, that was in part because of the prevalence of Saga and just being a deck that also had a set of Wastelands was a good way to win the Saga mirrors. And also with these combo decks popping up and other decks which don't really care about the fair aspect of a Saga, like you play Saga against Oath is going to come out well in that exchange, or you play a Saga against like Beseech or Jewel, like if you're not disrupting them at the same time, they'll just go over the top of you and shrug that off. Having said all of that, I think Saga is still this complete fundamental lodestone to the format, and part of that is because it is propping up both of those opposite extremes at the same time. So if you look at the Lurrus control decks, once you've committed to being both a reactive deck and one that has Lurrus, it becomes kind of difficult to find good win conditions, actually, unless you're pivoting into, I'm more of like the Jeskai deck with Ragavan and Arcanist and stuff. And Saga is just the best reactive win condition by a big margin. And then on the other extreme, when you look at like Beseech and Jewel, those decks want redundancy on their threats, but they also want ways to fight through interaction. And Saga is a really good threat, and it's a really good threat at fighting through the kind of interaction which is best against everything else in your entire deck. And in the in the Beseech deck specifically, it also ends up being like this weird mana fix a lot of the time, where it's either this Lotus Bloom, it's just suspending until it can get Black Lotus, which in turn sets up your Beseech or something else, or kind of same deal with like Mox Jet, Lotus Petal, stuff like that. It can also be the Beseech fodder that you need sometimes, or again, sometimes it's you keep a hand that shoves on turn one Ritual Necro or something, or you know, fill in the blank with whatever analog you like. They force that, like you force check them, they pass. Now both of you have nothing left, but you have an Urza Saga, and suddenly the onus is really on them to do anything about that or something powerful in their own right, or they're just going to die to your Saga. And that happens even against the decks which are meant to be good against Saga. Like the number of games I've won against Bug with various like Tinker decks where, yeah, okay, they are a Wasteland Force of Vigor Collect Oof deck, but they're still pretty bad against Urza Saga, even despite all of that. Like, the card just is so fundamentally good that even when on paper it seems bad, it just finds ways to impress anyway, in my experience.
Okay, so you're saying that this is the floor of the Urza Saga experience and it can only get better from here. Okay, that's fair.
I would say this is close to the floor, and it is still a format-defining card. So take from that what you will.
Okay, what about Time Vault? Because it keeps showing up in lists, and I keep playing with it in Manifold Key, and then I keep, like, I'm on this border of, like, it never actually happens, but I'm always like, ooh, I can play to activate Time Vault this game, and that's how I'm supposed to win. But then, like, is it, like, the card that gives you an out in the spots where you're, like, 83% to lose?
I think it is, yeah. Like, often you will steal games because you drew one half of the combo, and you can find some route to the other half, and if that's possible, that is usually, like, the most mana and card efficient way to actually steal a game that was lost otherwise, because all of the other tactics, even the best ones in the format, like Tinker into Citadel or whatever or other stuff, those have their own like setup requirements, and usually if you're under the gun in that way, right, like your life total is very low, but it's a Citadel, maybe not at its best anymore, or stuff like that. Whereas Time Vault plus Key, unless you get yourself trapped under your own mana crypt, which has happened more often to me than I care to admit, like, that just ices the game. And having that deterministic, I'm going to say, win available means you can afford to kind of let other stuff pass to a much higher degree, because you always have this thing which you know will slam the door shut. You just need to get there. And often that's the easier part than anything else.
Okay, that makes sense to me.
That said, I only like it in the decks which have the black tutors. So, like when I was playing Blue-White Initiative, I ended up cutting Vault Key, because unless you have a way to dig up the Time Vault more consistently, you just don't want to be drawing a dead Time Vault a lot of the time. And the key actually is pretty good just as a card in your Saga deck, and that's part of why you can justify this package. But unless you have a way to dig up the kind of unique half, which is also the more conditional half when you want it, and to like ignore it when you don't, then I just wouldn't bother with that whole tactic.
Okay, all fair. Yeah, the key giving unblockable has come up a shocking number of times for me, so do not forget about that text.
Yeah, I mean, it's also a good way to break open these Saga mirrors. Like, if you have the smaller construct, one way you can win is just getting protected hits in with that smaller construct, and maybe using the other one to buy time against their constructs, taking one for the team. Like, I don't know, the key just, it is a good card, and then once you add in, like, you're making mana with Sol Ring or Mana Crypt, or you have the like extra card loop with Sensei's Vanning Top, or you just, sometimes it's even mana fixing, right? Like, you're short on blue sources, but you have an off-color Mox and a Mox Sapphire, and so you can like turn the Mox Ruby into a Mox Sapphire or something. Like, stuff like that just comes up much more often than you would think, and so I haven't yet flirted with what if I have a Saga deck with a key but no Time Vault, but it wouldn't shock me if to see one of those at some point.
The weirdest thing I have given unblockable is Lurrus to win those races.
Mm.
The lifelink has come up a fair amount there.
Yeah.
And that card can like never legally attack unless it's unblockable.
That's the other thing too, is that this is what draws me to the more unfair Lurrus decks, is that the Time Vault Key Engine, that can be attacked by stuff like Force of Vigor, but that this now gives you an actual win condition that Lurrus can like repair and piece together more easily. Like, if you lose your Vault Key to Force of Vigor, normally that feels pretty catastrophic, but it almost feels great if you're a Lurrus deck, because they made the trade that you wanted, but they're not. They're just delaying the inevitable, and the cards that actually answer Volki don't answer Lura, so you kind of get the best of that exchange.
Yeah, I mean, again, this is also another part of, like, the weirdo, like, four-color PO deck. Like, the red is basically just for Goblin Engineer, and that card is stellar in this exact role.
Yeah, in the same vein, I've thought about stuff like Lurrus Painter as well, where, you know, Painted Grindstone works well with Saga, works well with Lurrus, and maybe there's something in that space, but haven't really fleshed that out at all. But Vintage is, I think, still a relatively unexplored format, and you have a few individual people like really driving a lot of the innovation there, but if you were inclined to really take these tournaments seriously, I think you could get a deck edge as well as a just like general skill edge. And if there were more like open high stakes Vintage events, I think you would see a lot of like cool stuff kind of going on the fringes. So closing thought on Vintage then, I will say that if I'm just like giving a general recommendation, I think, you know, Oath is both a simple deck and a solid deck, and it does stand out to me that the like American raiding party that went over to Prague, you know, Justin Gennari, Brian Koval, and so on, they essentially all played a similar Oath list, and Justin undefeated in the Swiss and then lost in the top eight there. So I think that would be a very good starting point if you're someone who knows that you want to play Vintage at this tournament but doesn't know where to begin. And I think there are enough people like that that I would want to be prepared from for Oath or for the mirror, I guess, depending on what I end up on myself.
Oh, I did get hit with a PO opponent who just had like main deck Orchards as their land. And I think you could do this in Beseech as well, but like you have Orchard and then they just boarded into Atraxas, and I just couldn't kill them. Like I was playing Oath and I couldn't do anything. I couldn't show they might just have their Atraxa. I couldn't play Oath. They just have these Orchards. Like, I couldn't do anything. I had to, like, flash and then Citadel and then, like, that's just so convoluted against a combo deck that you're just dead.
Yeah.
It just floored me. I had no idea what happened.
You got defeated in the Arena of Ideas. But yeah, the Oath Mirror is a hot mess for that reason. And there is weird stuff that comes up, like, they go for Altered Oath, you counter it, and now you have Beseech fodder thanks to the token that they gave you. I don't know, there's a lot of weird stuff that comes up on the fringes there, but yeah, Oath, I think, in the dark, if you don't already know what you want, I think Oath is a fine default. If you do know what you want, there is something in Vintage in that space that is good and will satisfy you, and that's, yeah, a good endorsement to be able to give a format.
Yeah, really enjoyed playing it. I'm very excited to sleeve up power and play it at the North American Vintage Champs in a few weeks.
Yes, I am still on my quite elaborate side quest to obtain physical power for this tournament, which if that is successful, hopefully I get to tell the story of that in our, you know, collective tournament report there. But hopefully we have enough between us to cover in that tournament report that's just one more piece of the puzzle.
Yeah, I guess. Now, I don't want to say Legacy is the less fun part, because I've actually really enjoyed Legacy, but it is a different kind of fun than Vintage. Like I said, Vintage is all vibes, Legacy is all math, but like fun math.
Okay, elaborate on that part too.
So, I think that Vintage has really changed a lot over the years, and new cards have really influxed into the format, because the mana system just works completely differently in that format, and it still feels like Vintage because the mana dominates that format, but the texture of the games is very different. Legacy is the exact reverse. The mana system works exactly as it always has. There's only like there's only so much you could do to like handle Wasteland, Force of Will, Daze as like a constraining factor of the format. Like Dark Ritual is still the best way to make mana, or like Spirit Guides or whatever, like Ancient Tombs. Like it is all the same thing. Like it's not any different. There's new cards, but they're the same as the old cards. The same exact things are happening. It's just like there's some weird dynamics that like shift micro stuff. And it's the same Legacy where like I was talking about Vintage, where it's like, okay, so you get three cards ahead, then you get three more cards ahead, and they never get anywhere. In Legacy, it's the same thing it's always been, where like there's a fight. You have to decide if that's the fight you want to spend your cards on. And then if that was the wrong fight, you die because you're like down an advantage, but if it was the right fight, you're up an advantage. And that micro advantage, just because the cards are so constrained by those core mana dynamics, there's not a lot of cards that rectify large, like the small advantage is hard to recover in a large way a lot of the time, and therefore the player who gets like two ticks ahead is just so far ahead the rest of the game that it's over. And again, it's like the Wasteland Days Delver stuff that prevents you from being able to play cards that like go big over the top, because you just can't put them into your deck because they just never happen. So it's just still Legacy. But there, I think the biggest thing that has happened is that Bowmasters is some inbred bullshit in Legacy, is the way I would put it. I have not felt like Bowmasters is a powerful card against anything except for other blue decks. The problem is that it's really messed up in blue mirrors, to the extent that, like, so one of the developments I think we've seen with the four color list is that the default a while ago was that you just had fourth Irulingus in your deck. I don't think that you want the white and, like, you don't want red in your deck, I don't think. I don't know which color you're supposed to cut. But I think that the list that Alex Vestecki top aided the SCG with, that had, like, it was four color but black for Bowmasters and your big finisher was Murktide, I think that that is just generally a better four color list. And this rotates around to the issue of, like, if you play a blue mirror and they are the Bowmaster side and you're not, you have this problem where, like, they're allowed to brainstorm to make their hand good and you're not. Because if you just brainstorm on, like, your brainstorm becomes a tactical card where you have to be like, okay, I'm going to brainstorm and I'm going to have to fight. Like, it's not like before where it's like, if I brainstorm and it gets countered, that's just a resolution. Like, if you brainstorm and they Bowmasters, you die. Like, it's just over. The game ends. Like, it's not remotely recoverable in any game I've ever played. So, like, you have to be prepared for them to do that, which means that you, like, need your own Bowmasters. I think that this is, and, you know, Juju being one with the non-Bowmasters Delver deck in Europe in the Legacy Champs, the Questing Druid deck, I like that deck a lot more than Grixis. The problem is that if you just play the Grixis Mirror, every time they play a Bowmaster, it kills your creature, and then you have to kill the Bowmaster. Like, it's always a very specific 2-for-1 where it's like, one of my best cards on the battlefield is dead, and I have to have a specific answer for this, otherwise the game is, like, virtually over by Legacy standards. But again, then the other, like, 60% of the metagame that isn't, like, 4C Delver, like, I don't think Bowmasters is a good card.
Yeah, I broadly agree with that assessment, and I think that for as much as initially it seemed like Bowmaster was going to homogenize Legacy, it still is a very popular, very effective card, but I think that you kind of have to know what you're trying to do with your Bowmaster now, as opposed to, well, it's kind of good against everyone, so I'll just put it in my deck. There are a lot of decks which, even if they theoretically have some, like, small creatures you can shoot down, or theoretically they are drawing cards at some point in the game, they just don't actually care that much about your Bowmaster. And for maybe the non-blue decks who suffer by being non-blue decks because they can't be, you know, unlocking the consistency of Brainstorm and stuff like that, but they can be good Bowmaster decks in their own right, I think the Bowmaster is kind of a neat addition in that context, just in terms of giving them some, like, good firepower against the blue deck. So stuff like Painter, for instance, which I think has struggled historically with some of the Delver decks, arguably some of the control decks too, like, Bowmaster is, well, I want to say it's bad against Painter. The fact that I see just a set of Goblin Builders in every deck makes me kind of doubt that to some degree, but that can be a good Bowmaster deck too, and I think that goes some way to shoring up just the generic tempo or, you know, Delver deck matchup, when you can be a good Bowmaster deck backed up by the usual litany of, like, Blasts and Bolts and whatever. Likewise, there are a bunch of these, like, accelerated black stompy decks, whether it's like Helm or Reanimator or whatever, where I think if you feel like you're struggling against Delver, just having four Bowmasters somewhere in your 75 is like a decent kind of low cost pivot that shores that up to some degree. So I think, or similarly, like the Cradle, I'm not going to call them Cradle Control. I think that's kind of, that was a misnomer before, definitely a misnomer now, but just, yeah, you rock up with your four Bowmaster Cradle deck, like, that's a very good starting point. So I think that those are the kinds of Bowmaster decks that would almost interest me more, as opposed to the decks which are good Bowmaster decks, but also really bad against Bowmaster, and I just have to hope that I can work my way to the right side of that equation somehow.
Yeah, I agree there. I think it's hard to talk about any other broad strokes because the Legacy decks in general are just, like, very disparate from each other. But I have one other small category, which is, how do you feel about a lot of the color hate cards that have been populating sideboards? So, like, the blue blasts, the red blasts, Carpet of Flowers, like, I feel like there's something to unlock with the presence and usage of those, because they all do feel really powerful, but like it feels like there are ways they fall short and ways they excel, and you're supposed to sort of understand that in advance of putting them in your deck.
Yeah, I think all of them are a lot less reliable than they have been, specifically Pyroblast, right? There was a time where this was almost the best reason to be in red in your blue deck, is just to have Pyroblast against other blue decks. I think that's really not the case anymore. It's maybe more the case now than it was like a month ago, where the blue-black scam deck was the go-to like blue tempo deck, the Fun Police, because that deck, the black cards were what really made that distinct and set it apart. And for a lot of decks, those were the scariest aspects, where there were decks which maybe thought that they liked their double matchup, although everyone likes their double matchup a little bit too much, but they were scared of scam because of, you know, the Thought Seizers and Griefs and like increased graveyard hate and so on. And that is one trend I would be watching here, is if your deck struggled with scam but liked its Delver matchup, I think there will be a lot less scam after its underperformance in Prague and a lot more just Teemer / Grixis Delver. And so if your deck falls into that bucket, I think that's a really encouraging sign. But even more broadly, right, you look at the various four color decks, can Pyroblast hit any of Up the Beanstalk, their own Carpet of Flowers in the Blue Mirrors, their Bowmasters, their One Ring, their fourth Eolingus. Like, there's just so much stuff which you really need to hit with something, and Pyroblast cannot be that something, that it's just, it's unreliable now, which also is why, to jump ahead a little bit to Painter, that's a deck which really appeals to me conceptually, to the extent that I have to, like, check myself to be sure that I'm not talking myself into it. But I think just the core premise of it relies on Pyroblast being a card that you already want to main deck, and now you have an excuse to main deck like 6 or 7 copies of that card. And I just don't think the format is in quite that place at the moment.
No, it feels like Pyroblast is largely destroy target Murktide Regent backup plan of just like chucking it at Brainstorm, Ponder, Force Will, and hoping that works out.
I
found Hydroblast to be way better.
Yeah.
Hydroblast is messed up these days.
That is an important tactical thing, though, right? Of, once you know that, if you are a Pyroblast Exile, you have to be more willing to fire it off on like a seemingly unassuming Ponder or something, because you might not have a chance to line up against a real threat. And, or one other way of framing it is, you might not need to save it for that larger threat. So just, you can afford to just trade one for one with a card that might, you know, smooth over some inconsistency in their draw.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. This is something I might get into over the general, but I feel like right now I feel really good about my legacy heuristics on the early turns, which have always involved just like, I think that to some degree legacy has a similar trend to vintage, where there are a lot of powerful ways you can lose the game relatively early on. Not like, not just talking about like, oh, they went City of Traders, Chrome Mox, Blood Moon me on turn one, I don't get to play the game. I'm talking along the lines of, like, even in Delver Mirrors, where you just, like, okay, I'm on the draw, I'm taking my first turn. Am I allowed to cast a one drop? Am I allowed to play Brainstorm? Like, what is my hand even doing? How do I even beat everything? So I think that I am much more inclined to just, like, when it feels like a spot where I can take, where I can cut the margin and just, like, you know, fire off a Wasteland or a Ponder on their, you know, like, key resource early. I feel like that is a skill in the format I do a lot more than other people, but, like, feel like I'm evaluating those spots really well, where just, like, they feel weak, this is time to move. And so, like, those Ponder plays were already in my repertoire. The problem I run into is that, like, if you just proceed past that point of the game, and it's not, like, very clear, like, you get into these muddled, like, turn four situations, that's where I just fall apart in the format. I don't really understand what I'm supposed to be doing.
When you've been doing this kind of exploration into the current state of Legacy, what has stood out to you for good or for bad reasons, and where do you think it makes sense for us to start things off?
I mean, we can start off with the fact that, like, I'll just play Boros Initiative if nothing else excites me. I just, like, you play the deck, and then you win a lot, and then you play other things, and you feel like maybe I could win more, but I don't know. I like it a lot. I think that the simplicity of playing it is a bit overstated. I think that there's some good tactics. I don't know. It's so a good deck. I don't know what else to say.
My story with the Initiative deck is I became Initiative curious, especially after watching Jarvis's review of XJ Cloud's Showcase Top 8 with it. And then I watched one Bottom Roll video where he tried the deck, and it was it seems like one of the more miserable experiences he had in a long and storied Magic career, and that was enough to get me off it. I told, you know, Danny Bannerman and I was no longer keen in discussing initiative, left the Discord, whatever. I don't know. It feels like to me, I know the deck has been doing well enough that like you have to respect it, but there's some amount of psychologically, if I'm signing up for a large, long Legacy tournament, just flipping weighted coins and playing limit poker all day, even if that, you know, it's like going to give me a 53% chance of winning any given flip, I just don't know if that's something I want to do to myself.
Okay, well, I, on the other hand, am totally fine with this. But I respect if you want some more agency.
Well,
so,
it's not so much agency. I just, like, clearly, so I think the white cards in the Boros deck are all exceptional for what they are, right? Like, Archon often is just the best, like, stompy payoff card against a lot of people. Fourth Eolingus, fucked up card. Seasoned Dungeoneer, not quite right for him, Adventurer, but still completely messed up. I just don't know if, on balance, that whole recipe is better than just good old-fashioned mono-red stompy, which I think has gained some good new tools, and we can come to those in a second, but just the idea of my mana basically always works, and my threats are cheaper, and I get to be like a main deck Blood Moon deck and everything else, it just avoids a lot of the issues I had with the Boros deck of, it's not even clear I can cast my first big thing, and if I do, and it resolves, and it doesn't get answered, that might not even still be good enough, which doesn't really seem like an acceptable like fail rate for that kind of zombie deck with all of the other sacrifices you're making to be that.
That's a lot more conditional than I experienced, because usually I just found it's like, all right, here's my thing, that's good enough. Like, I think the cards are really messed up, but I'm willing to re-examine and be
specifically
wrong.
There's a conditionality to the initiative creatures that scares me, where like, yeah, if you are uncontested, your Caves of Chaos Adventurer, which isn't a cave for some reason, or Seasoned Dungeoneer, like that will run away with the game. But I mean, even in the mono white initiative days, like fully powered with White Plume Adventurer, that deck in the two deck format with that and Delver, it was just behind against Delver, because fundamentally it is hard to retain control of the initiative slash monarch against a deck with, you know, the card Delver of Secrets, but also just that recipe of cheap evasive threats and good disruption. It's just I think there's a ceiling on how good you can be against Delver once so many of your threads are tied up in that style of card, to where I just don't know if I want those. And at that point, do I want to be in Boros at all?
Yeah, I'll give you that. I'll give you that the Delver matchup is one of your worst matchups. And
is that acceptable?
I'm okay with it.
I mean, it's...
I understand not being okay
with it. I think it's a finer thing to choose to not perceive now than it was like 3 months ago, but that still seems like a big risk to me.
Sure. Beyond that, I think that I've also sort of found myself in this like cycle of like, I don't know if any of the blue decks actually wins, and I don't know, like, it's this weird thing, like I said, this is where the Bowmaster stuff comes from, where like, it feels like they're in this weird inbred cycle where I don't even know which of them is supposed to beat any of the other ones based on like exact cards chosen, and like, I don't feel like there's like decisions that are clearly good against the rest of the format in any of them, because like sometimes when they look good, they look really good, and sometimes they just look really bad, and I just don't know how to feel about any of them, except for Dimir Scam. I think that deck is just like unplayable trash and it's built, and you should just rebuild it from the ground up. I don't even know where to start with the deck beyond like okay, so you're like throwing away cards for these like a lot of plays, but like you're also like a Force of Will, Thoughtseize deck. But also, you're, like, trying to be a Resource Denial Wasteland deck, but, like, you can never afford to Wasteland, because if your opponent has Urza's Saga, you instantly die. I just don't really... Like, it also has the grief problem where, like, your grief is a 3-2, and it's like, okay, what now? Like, who cares? It's like... I don't know. It's just, like, grief ephemerate. It's... Or, like, you reanimate a troll, and then you just die to a Delver because you just paid 6 life. I do not like that deck.
It's also a pretty heinous Daze deck in my experience as well, which...
Oh, yeah, no, too.
You can just cut the Dazes from your deck. You're allowed to do that, but, like, Dazes is also a messed-up card. Part of the appeal of these blue tempo shells is getting to leverage that card to full effect, and so I would rather just play a Delver deck that can do that, or if you want something in the space, I think just relatively stock Shadow is a perfectly fine deck that is just a mostly better version of what this is trying to do. Yeah, and then on the blue control decks, like the bigger blue decks, I agree that I don't have a sense of in that space, like how you get an edge, what's meant to be what, how you do that without giving up some stuff over here or against the format at large. And so that wards me off from giving any kind of like confident analysis of those, because I just don't feel equipped to do that. But it also wards me off playing those in a tournament, because even us leaving aside like, oh, you're playing some 700 person legacy tournament with 10 rounds, like just that's an endurance contest as much as anything else, and a control deck is not the best choice in that context. It's also just, will I know what I'm meant to be doing, right? And am I going to realize in round 3 of 10 that, oh, I wish my deck was like different colors and either 20 cards bigger or 20 cards smaller and had this different removal suite? Like, I don't know, even if I locked in a blue control deck right now and devoted all of my efforts between now and then, ignoring other formats, other decks, to just mastering those, I don't know if that would get me across the finish line.
I think my issue with them is not that they're like too hard. Well, I guess some of it is, I think there are pressures that make it so that I think the round clock is a noticeable problem for these decks. Like, Fourth Aerolingus is just such a bad card in games where your opponent is not the round clock that it's just not worth playing. I think Uro is really busted, and I think that is the best thing that these decks have going for them. My issue with these decks is that I think, so what I mentioned about like the ability for opening hand stuff to line up really poorly is just really evident in this deck, because your idea is that you take over the game starting on like turn 4, and I just don't think it reliably gets you to that against the full spread of the format with the full spread of its hands. I think that this is the most vulnerable, like when I'm talking about like, oh, you could used to be able to just brainstorm and fix your hand and then everything was good. This is the deck that like loses the most by not having access to that anymore, and it happens so much with it that I struggle to believe I'm interested in the deck at that point. I respect what the deck is trying to do and understand that there are a good percentage of the games that it's going to win, but the weakness is just like really glaring, and like it almost feels like it is easier for opposing decks to generate a plan that beats four color than it is for four color to generate a plan that beats them in return.
Yeah,
which is a really bad place to be for a control deck.
Yeah, I wonder how much of the issues that various modern four color decks have had kind of carry over here, where on paper these decks should just be kind of unbeatable, right? Like they should have the tools to keep up with everything, and they have just really good cards across the board and all of the components for a control deck, like the interaction, the card draw, the removal, the threats, all of those. Like we have had some bangers in each of those categories in the past few years, more than you can even play at any one time these days, and yet it just feels like it's less than the sum of its parts somehow. And certainly that's been true of almost all of the four color decks in modern, and it feels true of the four color decks in legacy as well.
Yeah, excessively so. Just the pressures are so much more extreme. Again, also like you just keep a hand with like two lands and then one of them gets wasteland and you're like, well shit, that was the one I needed.
Yeah.
So like more than any other deck in the format. Delver, I don't want to spend too much time on Delver because it's just Delver. The one thing I'll note is that I think that this is the worst having a single Delver in play has ever been. It's just like, it doesn't feel like it's a decent clock, but it's not a fast enough clock. It's always like the second threat that makes it very clear that the game is over. But like it's a weird spot where like Delver and Channeler are both good cards, so you don't really mind it. Just something to note. Also, Murktide Regent's messed up. Love that card.
Yeah, I wish I was the type of person who enjoy Delver and was good at Delver, so I could just register Delver in every Legacy tournament and not have to agonize like this. Given that I'm not, like, maybe I should be, maybe that is a fixable problem in my life, but for now, I am floundering around with everyone else.
I kind of feel like I've kind of backdoored into becoming a Delver player right now, just because the whole thing I was talking about with the format being, like, less about, like, because the spread of things that can go wrong in a game has become larger, the value of just like, well, how do I make it so that my opponent is the deadest without doing the most things possible? Like, that's right in my wheelhouse. Like, not the games where you're like, I'm going to make them pay a mana with Days on turn 5 and I need to think about this now. Like, that, I don't have that. I have the, like, I'm looking at an opening 7 and I know instantly whether I should keep my 2 wasteland 5 spells hand. Like, that's where I'm at with my life. And that's where Delver is right now.
I will say, despite Juju Bean's incredibly dominant repeat performance, like back-to-back Eternal Weekend winner, which is just astounding. It is 2-3 for the Bean, as it turns out. I think if I had to play Delver, I would definitely play Grixis over Teemer. I might even play Jeskai before I play Teemer, I think. I'm not convinced by the Questing Druid splash, and I think Bowmaster is just too important in both the Delver, like, pseudo mirror and against the generic, like, bigger blue decks. I would want to be there.
No, I think Questing Druid is the real deal.
Okay.
There's, on the list of cards that actually, like, it is one of the few cards I have felt actually provide the immediate sort of big swing that is missing in a lot of other spots at a relatively low cost. But again, like you said, the problem is literally that it's very hard to justify being the non-Bowmaster side of the Delver mirror.
Fair enough.
Questing Druid, I think, is the real deal. But because of this whole dynamic, it's hard to convince myself to play Delver, but I guess there's another category. I've seen a lot of Stifle Knot going around. I don't buy into it, but I have seen a lot of it.
I want to believe in that. And how far are they going with this? So, are we talking Urza Saga, dress down Stifle Knot decks, or are these?
Yeah.
Okay. I could be talking to that.
I've seen a mix of all of it, but I don't know. I just wanted to bring it up as a thing that exists that, I was playing Creative Technique, and I just, cast my Creative Technique into a Delver player, and then got stifled, and then my entire life was like, oh, no, I know exactly what's happening, and this is why this happened to me.
Yes, does sound weird to, have a bunch of dress downs in my Urza Saga deck, where, if I'm doing this thing, I can't even make my contracts in advance because I'm about to immediately nullify those. But if I'm getting a 12-12 out of the bargain, then that's probably okay. That's a good consolation prize. So you could definitely talk me into something in that space. If we want to cast off the blue cards for a moment and cast our eye further afield, where do we want to start there?
Maybe let's talk about combo, because I did mention a combo deck, but the other two categories are right. There's Ancient Tomb not blue, there's Non-Ancient Tomb not blue, and then there's combo not blue. So I guess combo, I would hard pass on the Mississippi River deck. I got one league with it to get it out of my system, and I played against three Obzon decks and it went 1-2, and that was kind of my limit. It's just, if you're losing to decks that don't have Force of Will with your combo deck, because just structurally, you are weak to a lot of other ways that you just don't get to go off. Don't do that. That said, it is resilient in a lot of ways to, just a little bit of interaction, but I just don't think there's any Legacy deck that's built
that. That reminds me, while we're on the topic, if you are some kind of, Green Sun Zenith deck, I think you should 100% have a Gaddock Teague in your main deck at this point, because it's your best card against all of the big blue decks, and it's your best card against the broad sweep of various combo decks, which, some of them care about Collector Oof, some of them don't give a shit at all about Collector Oof. Basically all of them, except Literal Reanimator or maybe Doomsday, care about Gaddock Teague. So to me, that card is one of the sleeper hits, which is maybe just not tenable to be a Zenith deck in this economy, but if I were, that would be one big reason for it to me.
Okay, that is a good point to pick up. Another combo deck I would say absolutely not on is hardcore, the Reanimator deck. Don't do that. There was it was listed as Rakdos Scam in the Legacy top
yes.
8, which I think is I don't know, I guess maybe a better version of what Blue-Black Scam is trying to do, but that's not really a Reanimator deck. I don't even know exactly how to describe what's bad about the Reanimator deck. It's just not good. It's just not good.
I think it's a really good game one deck. I think it struggles after that, but to me, that seems fixable in many, many different ways. So I've seen all of the following plans. Turning into some black zombie deck with Bowmaster, Douthi Voidwalker, Plague Engineer, Opposition Agent, some mix of those. I've seen the approach going even bigger than that with Cyborg Ancient Tombs and then the initiative creatures in black. I've seen the same thing with Shieldred over some of those initiative creatures. I've seen just Urza Saga in the sideboard, which well, I'll have a lot to say about that card once we get there, but that card is as messed up here as it is everywhere else. It seems you should very easily be able to present a deck that's your best draws will still get shot down by Graveyard Hate, but it's not going to be absolutely crippling the way that it should be. But you should be able to create this mismatch where the games where that is true are not the games where the opponents will have that card, unless your canister and your round one opponent is Mono Black Helm with four main deck ley lines, which it happens to the best of us even.
Yeah, I guess from my point of view, my experience with Reanimator is that I think you're not necessarily good against Boros Initiative, just because a lot of their hate cards just line up well enough and they kill you fast enough. I don't think you're that well positioned against Delver, and at that point, like, two of the best decks in the format, you're not actually a game one deck against, so what are you doing?
I kind of think right now you are pretty good against Delver, where they... You don't care much about either of the cards that they will be splashing for, and there aren't a ton of, like, main deck force negations, so you... And a lot of the ancillary stuff, like Spell Pierce or whatever, is at a low as well. So you often don't need to fight through more than, like, the first forcible, even if they have that, and it feels like a tight, focused, reanimated deck in game one should be able to do that most of the time.
I am not sure I've had that exact experience, but I'd be willing to believe the margins are better than they have been. I fundamentally don't believe in Reanimator against Delver being a positive matchup on the whole. Like, just the entire logistics of it.
There are also some incredible hybrid decks. So I don't know if you saw the Matthew Vogt deck, which was essentially a black-green scam with a bunch of reanimation spells, and your package for your four Entombs was like one Atraxa, one Arcanum Cruelty, one Hogak, and so you could either just like do the fair grief scam thing, or you could, with your four Generous Ents and four Trolls, like, you would basically always have a decent thing to bring back on the cheap if you wanted it. But then also the Entombs let you just high roll them sometimes if you had the like Entomb into Reanimate or Anime Dead Start.
Yeah, that's the deck that top aided the EU champs. It was just Rakdos instead of
essentially
Enting. Yeah, that's interesting. I don't know. Oh, also just the fact that, like, you know, 20% of the blue decks just have Reanimate in the main deck. It's just a really tough ask.
Well, that I think this might be the exact deck that falls in that sweet spot I mentioned of bad against Scam, but a lot better against Delver. Like, that is just Reanimator, right? Like, that is literally the dictionary definition there. So that would make me more enthusiastic about Reanimator, although I would almost be more confused about what my Cyborg would be in my Reanimator deck than what my main deck would be at this point.
Yeah, that's fair. I'm looking at the list that ended up going 8-2 and Prague, and the sideboard is like four random creatures, some of which like already are in your main deck. Like, there's another Archon and another Gristlebrand for unknown reasons, and it's like, I don't know, here's some Gambits and some Extractions and some Brutalities. Like, it does not feel like a sideboard that is attempting to fix problems. It's just a sideboard that is just like, I don't know, hope this works, good luck.
Yeah, it seems like it should be fixable to me, but I will leave that to others to figure out for now, I think. For other combo decks, I know you've been Doomsday curious in the past. Are you still there, or has... I guess that might also be a deck which, like, really doesn't want to see Scam, and I guess really doesn't want to see Delver either, although I guess that's, like, a little more feasible, at least.
I think I gotta just go back and, like, pick it up and play a little bit with it, which... It sounds like a stupid thing to say about Doomsday, but again, like, I don't know. You're talking about, like, oh, this is the deck that plays exactly into my preferences. I feel relatively okay on low reps with stuff. I do want to try out the Mark Tobias top aided with the One Ring.
Yes.
That is kind of an interesting backup plan. I do like leaning into a large number of Veil of Summers, again, because if you even think that Bowmasters is going to be the problem, that's it. But, like, the kill conditions in Doomsday these days are pretty easy to figure out, just because Oracle has simplified everything.
Yeah, this whole, like, four-color Doomsday trend, these mana bases, just looking at them scares me. I guess they are functional enough, but I would not want to be Wastelanded consistently, even from otherwise undisruptive Wasteland decks, if I'm stretching things that far. Like, I could see the Tobias list actually struggling a bit with a deck like Lands, right? Like, where... Yeah, if your opponent is just wastelanding you a lot, main deck Sphere of Resistance in those lists, like, that's not as free as a matter like that should be for a deck like Doomsday, I guess.
That's totally fair. I will say that I don't think switching from Doomsday to True Storm fixes any of the potential issues.
Okay, let's dabble in that quickly, because with these Beseech decks, that can run the full gamut from either mostly traditional, like, Ad Nauseam Tendril style remodeled a little bit to have enough Beseech fuel, all the way to, like, the Tony Scaponi, like, mono black artifact centric Mox Opal deck, which existed before Beseech but will quite happily pick up Beseech at the same time.
Yeah, I think that there's just enough, like, random side. Like, you're like, there's no main deck forces. Like, there's sideboard ones. The Delver decks don't need that much to actually crush the combo plans. Again, this goes back into the same category of, like, it's bad against Delver, and I don't love it against Boros in it, so I don't really know what it's accomplishing. Like, this has been a classic problem for Storm, has been that whenever an Ancient Tomb plus Lockpiece deck is one of the better decks in the format, it just generally struggles, because anytime it loses the coin flip, it doesn't have a force will for whatever they're going to do. And the ways those decks kill have accelerated rapidly to the point that you can't even, like, have some weirdo backup plan to get out of it.
Yeah, I do enjoy that these Storm decks now get to sideboard just, like, a big stack of Besiegers as a all-purpose response to, like, various hate pieces. But I think that once you're doing that and also trying to support the Besiege stuff, and, like, those mana gate bases get pretty funky. Like, if I'm going to fire a shot at a four-color Doomsday, then I can't not, point that out, too.
You're not Besiegering Archon. That's part of the big problem. It's like, you've got to beat Archon, and you have to beat Chalice, and you have to beat, like, the games where your hand is a bit slow because of interaction. There's like, okay, here's a Caves of Chaos, and you're just like, well, I'm dead.
Yeah.
The game is over.
I will say, I think Dressdown has been a pretty impressive way to cover that in, not just the Vintage Besiege decks, but, like, I mean, not to go back into Vintage content for too long, but Dressdown might be my pick for the most underrated card in Vintage at this stage. Just phenomenal against the card Urza Saga, against Oath, against Initiative, just, and especially in these combo decks, like, it really takes out a lot of the stuff that you really care about, whether it's Lavinia, Hall Breacher, Archon, whatever. So yeah, that card, absolutely phenomenal. Not as much of an all-star in Legacy, but I think still underrated here, like, in these combo decks, but also in, like, the four-color decks, for example. I think a lot of those decks don't really have a good plan against Urza Saga for the most part, and this is a good kind of a high-floor way to actually give you some insurance against that.
Yep, I endorse Dressdown 100%. We'll get to another reason why I endorse it 100% coming up, but yeah,
all right.
Big fan of that.
The final combo deck that caught my eye, Prison Mike stan as I am, this is not Prison Mike, this is a full-on turn one combo you, Mike. This is the Mystic Forge Wandering deck with a bunch of Manifold Keys and Grim Monoliths and stuff, the 8-key deck. To me, and I'll come back to my, like, unified theory of Legacy and what I want in a deck as we wrap up here, but to me, this feels like the deck which on paper should be, like, completely phenomenally busted, and there are tournaments where it looks like it is. Like, I think did very well at the Mana Traders event, and people like Cherry X-Man just consistently crushing the Legacy challenges with it. But it also has some of that same, like, Vintage Jewel property of the gulf between what I ordered and what I got can seem pretty substantial sometimes.
Yeah, I have that same problem with, again, it falls into the same category as Besiege, where I think it has the turn one fragility of, like, I don't really love this position against Delver, and I don't love it against Initiative, so I don't really know what I'm accomplishing. I guess the accomplishment may be putting Urza's Workshop into a deck, so look up what that one does.
Yeah, I don't know if I believe that that's the best, like, other colorless land once you don't have to care about making colored mana, but maybe it is.
Yeah. It's at least fun to say that it's in your deck.
Yeah, all of these decks and many others should at least have a Gemstone Caverns, by the way. Not going to keep beating that dead horse while I still have the breath to do that. But moving past the combo decks then, and kind of circling back into other stuff, this is where this tends to be my comfort zone. It's like the other stuff zone. Is there other stuff that you think is on the table for you?
I don't really know if I'm going to touch anything in the, like... So I don't really know if there's a functional difference between, like, the entire, like, spectrum from, like, elves to taxes to, like, various white-green knight stacks to lands. They all sort of feel like they're in the same mush. I guess elves is even a misnomer, but, you know. I don't think I really want to play any of them except for maybe the Knight of Reliquary decks. But I think some of that is a question of how big new fate card Legolas's Quick Reflexes ends up being.
Yeah, which my impression is it is pretty messed up, especially in the, like, Elvish Reclaimer Knight decks in particular. That said, even though I love that archetype, I don't know if it's going to be a great choice. I think that you struggle against Initiative, and you struggle with the blue control decks, and you're still good against Delver and so on, but, like, it's not as free as maybe it has felt sometimes in the past, and so you get to the point where, like, other than some other decks in the same bucket, I'm not sure what you actually want to get paired against.
Yeah, this is another one where I might just need to get some matches in with it and sort of see what's going on, but it's kind of weird to me there. And I don't think I'm going to touch lands. I don't think I'm going to touch taxes. I don't think I'm going to touch elves. I understand the sort of appeal of taxes, but I think the way the deck is kind of blown up is... I don't know. I don't think it's gotten functionally better against Delver. It still feels like you're playing the same games where half the time one player does nothing, the other half of the time the other player does nothing, and then, like, you move on with your life after signing the slip in some direction. Definitely not really, like, the best deck against the four-color decks that are, like, looping Terminus and making an Uro and doing all this stuff. As much as the Taxes players want to say they have, like, X, Y, and Z plan, I don't really believe it on that level. Like, I don't quite know there. And then I've watched the Elves deck play out, and it just feels like you're trying to produce something that used to be good, and you're not really getting there.
Yeah, lands is my other usual mainstay, and I have my doubts about that one too. Just so, for example, there have been a lot of lands lists. I think this is safe to say, like, the default build at this point that has main deck Sphere of Resistance, and a lot of the kind of lands purists, and I think Jarvis would take up this mantle too, just really philosophically don't like the card in the deck. I feel like it's almost necessary for the deck to at least be tenable in its bad matchups, but you could argue that if that's the case, maybe its positioning is just so bad that you really can't afford to be doing it at all. And then there are matchups where, like, the matchup is bad, but also some of those card choices like Sphere are also bad. Like, Initiative is kind of a nightmare in my experience, or like the mono red prison decks. It's just the same thing of, like, it's a good deck, but there are issues in such a large format which you just really fundamentally can't fix, I think.
Yeah, and especially with the blue decks being less homogenous, I think it is easier for things to go wrong for you in ways that it's not just like, oh, I have to beat Delver, and I had, like, it used to be like, I have to beat Delver, I have to beat Miracles, and now it's like, I kind of have to beat, like, these six different Delver variants that all do slightly different things, and then also, like, three, four color variants that do slightly different things. It's not, like, especially clear in the games where I don't just, like, turbo wasteland lock them what I'm supposed to do to beat each of those.
Yeah, so I would love to just lock in one of those decks, but I think I would have to continue my search. The Elves slash Cradle deck, this is an archetype that I think does have a lot of potential and room to grow, but you only have this, like, quite small cabal working on it, and the decks get increasingly adventurous every time, it seems. And so I think that there is something there, but the version that I would want to register will probably look like 10 cards different at least. But yeah, I mean, the core of, like, you are a deck with a bunch of tutors, so when the hate cards you can Zenith for are good, then you get a lot of, like, free equity there. You're doing something, like, pretty fundamentally powerful. You go over the top of any deck when left to your own devices, and then you can just be, like, you know, Bowmaster deck, whatever. Like, that basic formula does look good to me. How you're meant to flesh it out is unclear. Not to derail things too much, I think this is maybe the exact deck where I think running more than 60 cards might actively be correct, and it's kind of a mistake not to do that, but discussion for another time, maybe. I will say, if I'm doing this stuff, I'm just going to play for Bowmaster. Like, it is both a thing I would want to tutor for with my Zenith or my Artisan a lot of the time. I can't even do that with my Zenith. I just want to draw it, so I'm going to increase my odds of drawing it, and then maybe decrease them by playing more than 60 cards. And also, in my Cradle deck, like, this is just two bodies to my Cradle. Like, what's not to love? So yeah, play for Bowmaster. You can figure out the rest, I think. But there's a lot of stuff you can do in that space. Like, you can have Delighted Halfling be your main mana creature, and then that bridges you between, like, your Gaddak Teague and your Leovold, or, like, whatever random legends you want a Zenith for. And then this is also a deck which gets a lot from the cards which don't exist on Magic Online. So Morlock, I mean, any Zenith deck benefits from that, but this one in particular, just given your mana generation potential with Gaia's Cradle, and then stuff like Toxicroak and, you know, whatever down the line. So this is a thing which, like, if some Cradle main showed up with a very weird looking list with cards you didn't know existed and did well in Pittsburgh, like, that would not shock me at all.
That's fair. I struggle with the statement of, like, left to its own devices, because I just don't feel like that happens a lot in this format.
Sure.
From what I've seen of the deck, it's a lot more like all your stuff sort of keeps dying and you're, like, barely trying to keep your head above water, and then, like, you've realized you've expended all your resources on that. So yeah. I have a big question mark by rhinos because it keeps showing up in top eights of events like every often enough that I'm just like, what is this doing here? And then I forget about it. And I think that the other big category is just like ancient tomb decks where beyond initiative, I don't really know why I'm supposed to be playing with any of them. But like they're intriguing enough that I want to know why.
Yeah, so this comes back to my kind of big theory here, which is that Urza Saga, it's not quite as messed up as it is in Vintage, but it's still really, really good. And Ancient Tomb with Urza Saga is a match made in heaven. And then I'm in this weird duality of thinking that most of the existing decks with that package have other like fundamental flaws that are scaring me away, but also that there are a lot of current Ancient Tomb decks that probably could also be Urza Saga decks, and that might be enough to hook me in. So even weird stuff like, I don't know, Sideboard Urza Saga, where the idea of I will just play a 3-drop or a 4-drop every turn and get it dazed or get it swords or something, and hopefully one of them will stick at some point. If that strategy doesn't sound great to you, well, maybe just, I don't know, play Urza Saga with all my fast mana against the people who need specific answers that don't answer Urza Saga. Like that, I don't know, that seems like a good juke to me, even in like my mono red deck with main deck Blood Moons or something. Like you are allowed to do the thing with which Painter actually does of having both in your deck at once. And the thing, one thing that drew me to Painter, aside from just being cool as hell, is yeah, this is a really good like Ancient Tomb plus Saga deck. It has other issues, like I said, I don't know if the Pyroblasts are that good right now, and all of the lists I see look very kind of all over the place, where you've got one for one removal over here, you've got these combo pieces which don't do a ton on their own, and then I've got like, you know, a random Lotus Petal or Mox Opal or something, and then these Goblin Welders and Goblin Engineers, which if they live, they're great, but they probably will die on sight, and then all these other cards which are in the deck to work with those, and so if those aren't working, then those probably aren't working either. It's just, it's a lot of stuff, and if you clean that up, maybe there's something there, but the actual Painter shell as it stands right now, I think is a little loose. But it seems to me, just from the ground up, there should be some like artifact centric Ancient Tomb plus Saga deck, which I guess lands kind of is too, that is exactly what I want, but I don't know what the rest of what I want is yet. So maybe it's the like Mystic Forge Khan Ring deck. Maybe it's I've tried like mono blue stompy based around that, like we don't need Cedric anymore, we've come a long way since then, and like I've tried 8-cast, but that's kind of awkward in a Bowmaster role, but I think the casts were always the worst part of that deck anyway, so what else can you do in that space? And then the aforementioned Tony Scipione won a challenge with like mono blue paradoxical outcome in Legacy, which was kind of interesting. So I think that is a whole like area of design space, which if this tournament were in an additional 3 months, I would really want to mine every corner of that. Given that it's in 2 weeks, I have no idea what the hell I'm meant to be doing there.
Okay, I guess there is one Ancient Tomb deck that I want to bring up that I think is worth discussing that I don't know if I can recommend playing, but it feels like it has been better than any of the other ones except for Initiative, and that's Goblins.
Okay, this is like the Turbo Muxus deck?
Yeah, well, so I think part of the problem is I don't actually understand how name sticker Goblin works versus underscore 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 Goblin works.
It is. Yeah, there's some weird difference. I don't think it moves a needle in terms of the actual performance in practice. But my bigger issue there is that a lot of the builds are playing these goblins, which are like holdovers from normal vile goblins circa the early 2010s, which I think don't make sense in like an Ancient Tomb world. So Goblin Warchief, for example, it's like, okay, yeah, if you can somehow cast that one, which is non-trivial, and it lives, then the next turn you might get a discount on a further goblin. But why not just play a good 3-mana goblin? Like there are so many good ones, like even in the normal mono red stompy list, between like 10 different Rabble Master variants and Namesake of Goblin, Fable, and the new one, to bring this full circle, the Bombardiers from the Ixalan Commander set. That card is incredibly messed up. Like this is a fantastic Muxus hit, but also just in normal mono red stompy, this is yet another good 3-drop, which means you don't have to run like the Caves of Chaos Adventure or anything above 3 mana anymore, except like the Fury, which you're casting for 0 and then sacrificing to your Bombardiers to deal an extra 7 on the way out.
Yeah, I mean, I have really liked the Rabble Master side of this, where you just get to like gun at your opponent with early threats, and then it's like very unclear like exactly how they're supposed to structure the way they play the game to like not die to those, not die to Muxus. But I am interested in some bombardiering for sure.
Yes. So you may catch me bombardiering in the leagues. Not here for a long time, but perhaps for a good time instead. I think that covers basically everything. Is there anything else that you wanted to throw into the mix there?
I think that is about good enough where it's a very weird format. It's been fun to play, but it's very weird and hard to grasp.
All right, so calling your shot then, the tournament's tomorrow, what do you play? And then if you're playing something else by the time the tournament actually comes around in 2 weeks, what is that most likely to be instead?
If the tournament's tomorrow, I'm just like brain off playing Boros and It or Goblins. If I have 2 weeks, maybe a Delver deck, and I can see a world where I trick myself into trying Sneak and Show and getting baited, but that's about it. That's a deck that we didn't even talk about, but it's because it's the same thing that it's been for the last, 15 years.
And this is very much in the Discover N isn't even playing Doomsday camp of JPA has sworn off Sneak and Show for the time being, so you probably
okay.
should.
Nope, okay. Yes. Nope, you've convinced me, that's good enough.
Enough said. So yeah, for my part, tournaments tomorrow, I just play lands as I always do, wouldn't be thrilled about the choice. Given enough time, you might see me like begging on Twitter for Grim Monoliths or something, but that's still to come maybe. So with that, we will finish with a very brief check-in on the Modern Showcase results, because we had an episode bemoaning the updated Sailor Modern as it was a week or two ago, and the Showcase is a great venue to test people's assumptions about the format, and looking at those results, it's almost a flashback to the Pro Tour, where the idea of Scam being the big boogeyman there would kind of take you by surprise if you were just looking at the top eight.
Yeah, it is sandwiched by a lot of events where Rakdos is still winning a ton, but we do see like some pretty interesting new innovations with new cards.
Yeah, so the main one here being Tishana's Tidebinder in Rhinos. So this is the new Flash 3-drop from Ixalan, which is a 3-2. When it ETBs, it counters an activated or triggered ability. And if that ability was tied to an artifact, creature, or planeswalker, that permanent loses all of its abilities for as long as the card remains in play. So if it's a creature, like it's still going to keep its power and toughness and so on. But this lets you do some very tricky things, both against like known enemy, so yeah, they try and Fury Scam you counter either the return to play trigger from the Undying effect or the 4 damage from the Fury, or you find some way to mess that up. But even just stuff like the One Ring, right, you can counter either the fog mode or the draw mode, and either way you're shutting it off for the rest of time as long as Tidebinder stays around. And even just the base case that people love to chase of, yeah, I'll stifle your fetch land activation, right? Like, that's very much on the table here as well. So a card with a reasonably high floor and also a very high ceiling and a lot of tricky stuff, which makes the deck that much harder to play around, where I think this is why Rhinos does so well, especially in, I'm going to say especially in, like, less competitive settings, although did great at the PT and now in the Showcase, so does well on the other side too. But like, you pass a turn with 3 mana open, and that mana could represent all of 5 or 6 different things, which each have to be played around in their own distinct way, and people just lose their minds. And understandably, that's a very hard thing to balance around. But it is also, on top of everything else, it's a wizard, so your Flame Vanors can actually get to 2 modes without needing to put some like random out of place Mutavos in your deck.
Yeah, I do want to point out the Mangu pointed out a good thing with this card on Twitter, which is that if you stifle the Urza Saga trigger that grants the construct ability, like, that's a wrap. It doesn't have the ability. What's it going to do?
Yes, you can also, so you can actually counter any of the ability that lets it tap to make mana, which is an important one. You can counter the thing that grants it the ability to make constructs, or you can counter the Chapter 3 finding the cheap artifact on the way out, which against a deck like Hammer, Amulet, whatever, Hamulet, if you will, then that might be the most important mode sometimes too. So yeah, that doesn't answer all of a saga the way that it would against like random artifact, random creature, but it does enough to be worth it still.
Yeah, just reasonably flexible and powerful card in a deck that's always here for the right 3 mana interaction.
Yes. Meanwhile, it was a good week for the perverts out there, because 3 copies of Amulet in the top 8 of this showcase. We're speaking to someone who qualified for the showcase last time playing Amulet, and had said to them that, well, you're not going to have a target on you unless, like, in this last showcase, three Amulet players top eight. But what are the odds of that? Pretty high, as it turns out. Great performance in the showcase. And then the finals of one of the challenges at the weekend was an Amulet Mirror. The winner there, House of Mana, known Amulet pervert in his own right, also won another challenge last week with the deck. So a good time to be casting 6/6s. Less so now with, you know, rhinos with Tiebinder and stuff everywhere. Like, I can see that being pretty tough. But by and large, I think the deck has still held up remarkably well.
Can you explain the Tarrasque?
So this is a thing you can pact for against Elishnorn that then unlocks everything else. I think it might just be a scam or a bit, but it does at least do a specific thing if you care enough about it.
Okay, that's fair. That was my bridge into nonsense of the week, because we talked about a lot of serious stuff, because that card is nonsense, right? Like, it cannot be real.
Yeah, I mean, there's... Well, once you get into... 9-mana dinosaur territory, there's a lot of nonsense that has shown up in these decks over time. I was even joking about the idea of Dinosaur Amulet with, like, the new Hoatli and Wayward Sawtooth making its glorious return. You know, Commune with Dinosaurs then kind of back on the table, finding any of your lands or your threats. Like, I don't know, if Primeval Titan ever gets banned, we might still be cooking here.
Listen, I will let you and the Timeless Lotus perverts of the world discuss that when that happens. I do have one other showing of nonsense from the leagues, which is the literal Soul Cauldron. In the mix of all of these other Lost Caverns cards showing up, Souls of the Lost has kind of fallen by the wayside, but I did appreciate this mix of Souls of the Lost with Agatha's Soul Cauldron here. And, like, a lot of, like, weird little things that are showing up with plus and plus one counters that kind of bridge to each other in, like, okay, so Bowmasters, obviously, but, like, Stalactite Stalker, this is the new one-drop goblin that gets a plus and plus one counter EOT if you descended, Scornblade Berserker, and, like, this is another deck that gets to sideboard the Fulminator plus Soul Cauldron setup.
Yeah,
kind of interesting.
Yeah, this is really nice. It almost reminds me of some of the old-school Bridgevine decks before, like, you know, Modern Horizons really upended those and made those much more much less innocent, if you will. But yeah, giving me some of those vibes for sure. It's kind of nice to see Carrion Feeder alongside Gravecrawler and Citrus Supplier again. I'm kind of shocked that this isn't a grief deck now that I think about it. Like, this seems kind of like the perfect shell for all of that. And I don't know if, like, specifically Stalactite Stalker is gonna last for all too long, but yeah, I mean, this has the Citrus Supplier, Souls of the Lost curve that I spoke about in the preview season, and then just a lot of cool stuff with, like, Priest of Forgotten Gods with all his sack fodder, Priest with Bowmaster is kind of nice, Bowmaster with Soul Cauldron with Ballista, like, all the pieces, and Soul Cauldron with Carrion Feeder is pretty messed up too, like, all the pieces there fit together really nicely. So something in this space, I think, is going to have its flaws, of course, but, like, I think there's actually something pretty powerful there.
Yeah, looking at this deck feels good. That's all I have to say about it.
It kind of reminds me of when Soul Cauldron was spoiled. I tried to build, like smaller, fairer Yawgmoth decks with Carrion Feeder and, you know, Yawgmoth and everything else alongside Soul Cauldron. And maybe some inspiration from there could work as well. But, like, you know, Carrion Feeder alongside Young Wolf or something in my Soul Cauldron deck. Like, yeah, maybe there's room to cook. I don't know.
Maybe think on that.
Okay, I will rethink this. I will try and do better by myself in the future. In the meantime, though, we'll get you all out of here at long last. So you can find us on Twitter at Dom and Javier at ARMLX. You can find the podcast on Twitter at Dominaria_pod. You can find us on Patreon at patreon.com/Dominaria_judgment. You can find us both writing weekly still at SEG and CFB/TTG player, respectively. And you can find a lot of other nonsense being discovered literally and metaphorically over in our Discord. So links to all of that in the show notes. We'll be back next week with, I guess, a report from the trenches of my RC, just seeing how quickly and dramatically the sky actually fell, and if I have any fun news or scoreboards to point to there. So here's hoping on that front, but either way, we will see you all in here sometime next week. Until then, take care, everyone.